Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life. Hello and welcome to Namaste Radio. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Marie Bernard and I'm thrilled to be here with David Sarita. He is our guest today for an extended episode of Namaste Radio. We were going to talk about his quantum crystal jewelry, and we are going to talk about that, but after listening to some other interviews with him and his thoughts on time travel, UFOs, quantum physics, and so many other topics, I decided to extend the show. So we have a three-hour block set aside. We're probably going to talk for at least 2 hours, and then we'll see where the conversation takes us. We may be on the air until 4 o'clock. So please join us in the chat room, and you can always call in and ask questions. If you do have a question, the number to call is 1-347-202-0129. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks, Marie, for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. I know you're a busy guy with filmmaking and acting and writing. How did you find the time to even be on Namaste Radio?
Well, I love talking on the radio. I like it. You know, I've been on Anderson Cooper and news channels and the History Channel, Discovery Channel, but you never get to say anything on TV, so radio is the treat.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's the place to be.
Reveal all the secrets. I love that.
Yeah.
So let's start out with a discussion on the quantum jewelry. Now, you are... Explain what these crystals are and what they can do for people.
Well, actually, I mean, the story goes back to Marcel Vogel, who was a computer engineering scientist at IBM, invented some of the earliest hard drives, you know, for IBM. And he found that crystal has memory. In fact, so much memory that today at Stanford University in the 1990s, they were able to put separate movie files, which are the largest type of technical files you can put on a computer. They're putting them in crystals now. And they're saying that crystal has so much memory that they're literally going to become the hard drives of the future. We used to use crystal, germanium crystal, in our radio, you know, transistor radios and the little circuitry. We used them. We used crystals everywhere in electronics, and we started going away from it, which is really a mistake. There was a scientist named Gustave Le Bon who preceded Einstein in the late 1800s, and many people philosophize that Le Bon is where Einstein got most of his ideas on relativity from, and the photoelectric effect, which is the transference of light carrying packets of photons, little particles, which carry information. We're talking on the radio right now, and our voices are riding on radio waves that travel at the speed of light, or they're going through the internet at the speed of light. So information rides on light waves, electromagnetic waves, and then we reassemble that information at a distant location, and either it comes up as pictures or on the television or sound on the radio. So light is a carrier of information, but information can get trapped in a crystalline form. And so when I realized they were doing this, you know, I thought, I mean, I know I've been to India and I've been, you know, in a lot of the sacred temples there, and you walk into a place where mantras have been chanted for hundreds of years, you can feel it in the stones. And you go into the Great Pyramids, which, of course, are made of stone, you can feel the vibration. People talk about going in there. I've never been to the pyramids in Egypt, but I have been to Stonehenge, and I can tell you, you can really feel the vibration. So how does stone have memory? Well, the Native Americans call the stones the stone people because they actually carry information, and a shamanic priest can pick up a stone that's been informationized and actually hold it against their third eye or their body and receive the information that is imprinted in the stone. So what I did, you know, I worked in the field of quantum physics and with Nobel Prize winning scientists like Glenn Seaborg, Murray Gell-Mann, Norman Rostocker, Bogdan Magwitch, who was the discoverer of a type of non-radioactive nuclear energy in the 1980s and 90s, and I've since been a consultant for their company for years. I spoke in the United States Congress on nuclear fusion in 1993, and so I was around scientists for years. Later, you know, when our efforts to bring clean fusion power to the world failed and we found a huge conspiracy at the level of oil companies and giant corporations against us, our physicists went on to landmine and bomb detection, and they made me president of their company, High Energy Micro Devices. And so we were building new detection systems for landmines. And I got to see how physicists translated their knowledge and put it in a working device, a machine, a piece of detection equipment. And I realized, you know, this isn't really that hard to learn how to do this. And when I, you know, read the news about the ability to put information in crystals, I thought a stone, you know, a piece of rock and different types of rock and stone are actually microcapacitors, meaning they have the capacity to hold a very small amount of electricity, not like a battery. A capacitor is very different than a battery. A capacitor holds a larger charge than a battery in most electrical devices so that it can give a quick burst of energy into mechanical motion. So I thought, you know, what is it about crystals? So I started picking them up. I wasn't one of these crystal guys. I've been practicing meditation every day for 30 years now. I mean, I've been doing this stuff and transpersonal psychology and breath therapy and yoga and all this stuff since the 1970s, you know, with my father's influence. And so I thought, you know, what is this crystal stuff in the New Age? I really wasn't that into crystals. I thought it was kind of hokey, to tell you the truth, because I thought only meditation. You don't need anything but meditation. You certainly don't need a device like what I'm doing now are harmonically charged pendants that are made of crystal material. Well, what happened was there was a physicist at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, who actually got light to go faster than the speed of light, which is almost impossible in Einsteinian physics. His name is Professor Raymond Chow, and I spoke to him on the phone. And there was a big article in Science magazine that, you know, called Faster Than the Speed of Light. And what Chow did is he ran photons, packets of light, through lasers, through quartz glass, high-quality glass. And the photons went into a higher frequency spin state than they're already in, and they went 3.7 times the speed of light. So crystals acted as conduits for what you call, you know, possibly tachyons, these theoretical faster-than-light particles. But they also acted as conduits for what you call hyperdimensional physics, a super high spin state that light normally didn't travel in, and by going through this crystal circuitry, it could go faster than the speed of light. And at the time, I was like really excited about the possibility of using wave generators with crystal material to open up interdimensional portals to other parts of our universe where energies are vibrating faster than the speed of light. That's where I was at the time. So then I got a voltage meter, just a little simple voltage meter, and if you get a voltmeter and you put it on the millivolt settings, the human body has voltage. We have millivolts, and you can pinch the black and the red, which is the negative and the positive node on the voltmeter, and your left and your right thumb and index finger, and read your current. And no two human beings have the same amount of electricity in their body. In fact, I've now tested live at different shows over 800 people's body voltage. And what we found is people who had nervous system disorders like MS or fibromyalgia, my wife had fibromyalgia for many years, they had the lowest body voltage I've ever seen. And you have to think of your nerves as like electrical wires with insulation around them. They have this coating around the nerves. It's called the myelin sheath. So they're like wires, and we run positive and negative ions through our nervous system. Ions are bigger than the little particles called electrons that run through copper wires and light bulbs and light your computers and all these things that we use. They're bigger than those, but their ions are moving through our nervous system all the time, so we have current. And so I made this I did this study, and I said, you know, people who have certain types of illnesses have very low body electricity, and healthy people tend to have, in fact, this was a study done by William Tiller, Professor William Tiller at Stanford University. He tested the body voltage of the average person in different parts of the body and found the average person was between 50 and 100 millivolts. So we're not even 1 volt. We're not even equal to a 1 volt battery. If you think of that legendary scene in the movie The Matrix, you know, that all we are is just a little power cell. But we're amazingly efficient beings in that we use very little actual current in our body, and we're able to move muscles and heartbeat and brain waves. All this stuff is working on far less energy than a computer uses, and yet we're far more sophisticated than a computer. So then what I did is I developed real hard technology, and I developed quantum energy generators that could program vibrationally and put spiritual vibrations in certain types of crystal material that we use in these stone pendants. And what I did is just the plain raw stone, I would pick up a stone that was sitting in the sun and measure my body voltage before and during contact with the stone. And I saw this micro improvement. There was a little bit of more electricity in the body when I was touching a natural stone that had been sitting in the sun. And I thought, wow, that happens every single time I do it. So I realized, one, what could be contributing to a lot of depression in our world, in our modern world, and why there's an epidemic of depression in the modern world, is we are too insulated from our electrical and natural vibrational electrical environment. We wear rubber shoes, which are insulators, so we're not walking barefoot and touching the earth. Scientist Nikola Tesla, who worked for Thomas Edison, Tesla is the inventor of alternating current motors, which we use in blenders and we use them in fans. I mean, we use them everywhere. We use them to generate electricity. He's the inventor of that. He found basically that this whole system of the earth itself is highly electrical. The earth has an infinite supply of negative electricity, or negative, when I say negative, don't think I mean spiritually negative, it's just the polarity on the charge, electricity. So when you walk barefoot on the earth, you're actually getting electrified, you're getting a little bit of current from the earth, and it's improving the function of the brain and the organs. And so what we did is we insulated our feet, and then we started using plastics and rubbers everywhere in insulation, and all of our buildings that we work in are all completely insulated from this electricity. So we get cut off. Our energy gets very, very weak. And in addition to that, with the advent of telecommunication equipment, with the internet and cell phones, and not just cell phones and television, but we also have a huge amount of satellite communication going on around the planet 24/7. In fact, we have hundreds and hundreds of satellites that are orbiting the planet all day long, bombarding the whole Earth with this electromagnetic radiation. So what does all this very weak electromagnetic radiation do to the body? It throws it out of synchronicity. So one of the studies we did is when we, you know, when I realized that stone has memory, and I developed these programs, you know, programmable quantum energy generators, which can move electricity at the quantum level, which means smaller than electrons, smaller than the smallest particles you can really see so far in our basic view of electricity. What we did is we found a way to test different harmonic fields. You look at a natural harmonic field and a disharmonic field. And there was a scientist in Russia named Konstantin Korotkov whom invented what's called the GDV aura camera. Now, this aura camera is unlike aura cameras you see at New Age shows. This aura camera is so sophisticated that it can see how much energy is coming out of any one of the seven chakras in the body. If most people are familiar with the seven basic energy centers in the body. But it can also see how much energy is coming out of a particular organ, a nerve cell, a nerve ending, the hand, the foot, anywhere. And it takes the information and puts it in a numerical data form and transposes that information into a graphic of the whole human body, which in this computer software you can spin around in three dimensions and you can look at this person, their aura, in their auric field, you know, before and after you do a healing experiment, for example. So what we did in our film, The Voice, is we took five meditators, different age groups, and we did three different types of meditation. And we were about to use the GDV aura camera to see what happens to the human aura during meditation. And you'll see how this ties back into the stones in a few moments here. We put a glass of water in the room, and we used the aura camera to measure the energy levels of the water in the room. But the meditators were not focusing on the water at all. It was just there. It was there not as an attraction or a distraction. It simply served no purpose other than to measure the energy of the water in the room before and after these meditations. So we also measured everybody's aura before and after meditation, and there are five of us. There are two women and three men. And what happened was that before the meditations, the first meditation was a vigorous Sufi breathing meditation, which involves, you know, vigorous breathing and panting with the eyes closed to this kind of techno music while you're sitting in meditation pose and you're going through this journey of the chakras. And when you see the aura of each individual after the meditation, there is definitely an improvement, an immeasurable improvement in just 1 hour of practice. And it's quite remarkable how different meditators responded to the three different meditations we did. Then we did chanting the mantra Om for 30 minutes. And my wife, Crystal, I mean, it was really amazing to see what happened to her, because she left the meditation because she got so emotional. She was crying because she could see and feel all this love coming from her spirit guides. And, you know, someone might say, oh, this person's just having a fantasy and this isn't really real. But when we looked at her aura before and then during the meditation, her third eye in between the eyebrows, which is the vision center of the body, got huge. I mean, it was producing so much energy. You could see how much brighter her aura got in the third eye, and all it, which corresponded with her experience, which happened through the third eye. So then we did a two-hour sitting meditation, long sitting meditation, which everybody did before and after, measuring the aura before and after. And that particular meditation for me was the best. I mean, my heart chakra got huge. I was weeping of tears of love because I could see God was in ordinary sunlight, not supernatural light. Just the ordinary sunlight caressing the walls was just so incredibly cosmic to me in that state of meditation that I started crying, and it showed up on the aura camera. Well, what we had done after is after each meditation, Krishna Madhapa, who was running the aura camera in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where we did these experiments, he noticed that the energy of the water was slowly increasing with each meditation. The vibrational energy of the water, by the time we got to the two-hour meditation, had gone up almost 10 times, and no one was focusing on it. So what that showed is that our energy fields of our consciousness had inadvertently affected the environment. The environmental energy, the water, had actually improved in vibration. So what this tells us is that the spaces we work in our lives, the offices, the buildings, the environment, all of it actually has informational or vibrational memory. It actually is almost recording everything we're feeling and everything we're doing. But as I said before, electrically we're disconnected from the earth with our insulated shoes and insulated, you know, office buildings, and so we're losing our energy. In fact, we've used the same aura camera to show people's auras when a person is on a cell phone, and Krishna Madhapa found that the first three chakras, the base of the spine, the belly, and the adrenal section of the body, lose so much energy. The energy centers get very, very depleted. So the next thing, you know, we did is I started to discover, you know, what are some of the natural harmonies of the universe? And when we were making the film The Voice, I did a whole section on Pythagoras and his discovery of the music of the spheres, or the music of the cosmos. And Pythagoras, you know, the great Greek mathematician who is the father of trigonometry, you know, he is actually the father of modern music. He gives birth to the whole intervallic system of notes and keys, and the whole birth of actually the classical music movement is Pythagorean math and Pythagorean discoveries in music. But Pythagoras is a mystic, and Pythagoras practices meditation, and he actually tells you that if you go into the state of meditation, you can hear the sound of the sun. You can actually hear it. And this was really kind of a eureka moment for me because, you know, when I was living and growing up in Vancouver, British Columbia, my father, Lynn Sarita, who's a PhD in psychology from Berkeley, is teaching this Buddhist meditation retreat at our house down near Jericho Beach. And there's all these meditators in the room, and we're sitting cross-legged on a cushion, back straight, not leaning up against the wall, for 10 hours a day. Very, very rigorous practice. And on the second day, I just had this, you know, so much pain in my body from sitting, and it almost seemed so pointless to work so hard at sitting still. But suddenly there was this explosion of ecstasy that started in my belly. It just exploded through my body. And I erupted in this roarious laughter and had to excuse myself from the meditation hall. And I went outside into the park, and, you know, for people who know Jericho Beach in Vancouver, the willow trees were blowing in the wind, and then when I was walking, it's like most of my consciousness was not in the body. It was in this field. And this field was, I literally could feel the wind blowing through the trees as if it was wind blowing through my own hair. But the wind was like a wind made of ecstasy, and every time it blew through the trees, it tickled me. And the birds were walking on the grass. It felt like they were walking on my body. I could actually feel. I was so at one with everything, I could feel them. And I could hear sounds coming from every plant, from the willow tree. Every little blade of grass had a unique sound that was blending into this symphony of Om, the sound of Om. And I looked up at the sun, and I went, oh, my God, the sun is making this humming sound. It sounds like a mantra, like the mantra Om. Well, years later, I learned that in the Vedas, the Hindu Vedic system, that the true sound of Om is the sound of the sun. The sun is the sound of Om, and in effect, the sun is, in effect, chanting, just as Pythagoras had said it was. So I researched online, and I found that NASA had recorded the sound of the sun, which normally you cannot hear. It's inaudible to the human ear. And NASA compressed the long, slow waves in so that they became short enough that you could hear. The human ear can hear between 20 and 20,000 hertz, which are waves per second. So that's where we hear. We don't hear below 20 waves per second, and we don't hear above 20,000. You know, whales and dolphins and some birds can hear the really high frequency range, but we don't hear that. The sun was now in the audible spectrum, and I took the phone and I listened to it. It was so vigorous, this deep pulsing sound, and we decided to send the sound to Russia, where researchers were doing what Masaru Emoto was doing, and they exposed the sound of the sun to water, and they took ordinary tap water, which when you flash freeze it, it's like taking a photograph of the waveforms of water, and you look under the microscope and you see this very chaotic, not harmonious crystalline structure of the tap water. And then when you expose the sound of the sun to it, you see this incredible, beautiful restructured water. I mean, it's the most beautiful crystalline structure of frozen water I've ever seen. I realized that the sound of the sun, this symphony generator, was creating the harmonics of the solar system. It was the master of the solar system. In fact, the poet Dante Alighieri describes this when he's traveling out of body, and he actually travels to the sun, and he realizes that the sun is really the conductor of the whole solar system. So we took the sound, and Russian researchers decided to measure the human body, all of the chakras, before and after the body was exposed to the NASA sound of the sun. So when they exposed the body to the sound of the sun, they saw the heart chakra just got huge. It started producing so much more energy. And we realized that, oh my God, this sound could be used in medical ultrasound equipment to replace the sonics they're using today because it could invigorate the circulatory system of the body and improve heart and lung activity. So then what we did is once I developed these wave generators that could produce the effect of taking that information, not as an audio file, and actually program it into stones, we did it, and we did tests on the bodies electrical system with the voltmeter before and after a couple of minutes of making contact with the crystal pendant that had been treated by the sound of the sun. And again, we didn't do this sonically. We do it through these proprietary technology that I invented. And
so
you
So, David, is that like you're sending this information electronically? How are they?
We send it electronically, but it's not. You see, it goes through five different generators in my lab. The first two generators awaken the stone so that it can actually receive an imprint. You can't just send frequencies or radio frequencies at stone. If you do that, very little of the information sticks in the stone. So it's not easy to do this. You have to almost take the stone into a primal energy state so that it's programmable. So, and I figured out how to do that, and so once we did that, you then send the sound of the sun electronically through a wave file into the pendant, and it stays there. The memory, not the electricity, the actual what's called the information band actually stays in the stone, and it seems to stay there for years and years as far as we've tested. And what happens is when a person holds their thumb and index finger to one of these pendants, theoretically, it's sharing the information of the sound of the sun with them, and thus that explains why when they let go of the stone and retest on the voltmeter, their energy in their nervous system is much higher. It's at a much more healthy level, especially people who are really low, critically low. You can really see the energy increase. If someone is 5.0 on the millivolt meter or lower, that's low, and you almost always see an improvement. But I didn't stop there. I didn't stop there at all. I actually started to challenge a lot of the laws of physics in quantum physics. And this is a very, very deep subject and probably difficult to talk to about on the radio. But I started to even challenge the great Fibonacci sequence and what's known as the golden mean or the Fibonacci spiral. You see here all these people. You look at a spiraling seashell, a spiraling galaxy. And everybody says, oh, it's all Fibonacci. And I said, you know, that doesn't look like Fibonacci to me because I do a lot of math, and I started taking mathematical measurements on natural geometry versus man-made. Now, you see a lot of things in this New Age movement about sacred geometry and perfect triangles and perfect cubes and hexagons and dodecahedrons And I noticed that, you know, all these geometries, they look really fancy, and architecturally they have a certain, beauty to them. But I said, that's not what you see in nature. I picked up a six-sided natural quartz crystal, and I looked at the six-sided, structure, and I said, all the sides are uneven. They're not even-sided, meaning, let's take a triangle, and it's 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. Well, in nature, you would never see that. You would never see an even-sided geometry in any crystal form, either under the microscope, looking at, the crystal structures under the microscope, or just looking at natural, larger crystal formations like quartz crystals and leaves and flowers and all of it. Everything is uneven in nature. And I started taking measurements of everything from flowers to leaves to six-sided crystals to all sorts of natural forms. And when I took the measurements, I measured these uneven numbers in millimeters, very, very small, based on the 10 or decimal system. I didn't want to use inches because inches are not in a perfect, 10-fold environment mathematically. And I started recording all the numbers. And basically, my work got deeper. The more I looked at the numbers, I said, these numbers are not random. This isn't nature just doing a random show. And they're also not Fibonacci. Now, for those of you who don't know Fibonacci, Leonardo of Pisa, or Leonardo Fibonacci, was the great Italian mathematician who studied math in Persia and Babylonia, and when his father was traveling there in the 13th century, roughly, 13th century, and he precedes Leonardo da Vinci, and so he takes us away from the Roman numeral system, which is just fixed numbers, and brings us onto the decimal system, which is 1.002193, right? You see, or 1.125, as opposed to just ones and twos and threes, you know, all the way to 10 and hundreds. That's what we were on before. And what decimals gave us were fractions. And the only way you could see what I discovered in the harmonic codes of the universe were if you actually studied nature's architectures, nature's forms, you could actually find these numbers. And the Fibonacci number, it works like this. This is the great famous Fibonacci sequence. You go 0, 0, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. See, those are all Fibonacci numbers. But the way you get your Fibonacci sequence is you just keep adding two numbers in the sequence together to get the next number. So 0, comma, 1, comma, 1. So 1 plus 1 is 2, so your next number is 2. And then 2 plus 1 is 3, so your next number is 3. But 3 plus 2 is 5. You see, there's no 4 anymore. And then 5 plus 3 is 8, and so on. So the ratio of dividing the lower number into the higher number is supposed to eventually equal the great golden mean, which is a ratio of 1 to 1.618, et cetera, on the decimal series. So that's what everybody to this day who studies fractals, who, Mandelbrot, the mathematician who discovered fractals and the Fibonacci sequence was everywhere in nature. He said basically the Fibonacci sequence ruled nature as a harmonic principle. And I said, that isn't true. In fact, I found another number that is virtually everywhere that I could find in nature, and this is all in my electronic ebook, Differentials, The Hidden Harmonic Codes of the Universe. The number I found, what's that?
Where can people get that?
They can get that at voiceentertainment.net on the internet, voiceentertainment.net. So what I found was the ratio that was everywhere. I mean, in spiral galaxies, I found it in crystalline forms, I found it in planets, was the 1 to 1.111111. The ones just keep going forever. And I thought, wow, what a magic number that is. That is virtually everywhere in nature, not Fibonacci. Fibonacci is there, but there's a lot of fudging that goes on to make it look like it's really there. It is in certain places, but it's not everywhere. And I realized that the mother creation code in nature was the 1.111111. And I decided, no, that's not a frequency. You know, for people who understand, a frequency is how many waves or circles a spiraling waveform makes per second. A harmonic is a combination of frequencies working together whose differential ratio produce a certain set of numbers. And to learn how to do that, you really need to read that ebook. Very, very simple math. This is not Greek math and super complicated Einsteinian math. It's just division. So don't get scared that, you know, that I'm going to take you somewhere that's really difficult. It's just division, which you learn in practically in elementary school. So when I found the 1.111 was virtually everywhere, in fact, I even found it in flowers, the ratio of one, the radius of one petal in an orchid flower to the next was the 1 to 1.11111. And the great Greek mathematician Archimedes called these numbers perfect infinities because the numbers, the decimal series to the right, would go forever. I went, oh my God, if the 1 resonates forever to the right, then geometrically the space or the volume of space it represents is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which means it's eventually going to go into the micro-universe, and it's going to vibrate all the way down to the zero-point energy field itself. And the zero-point energy field itself is the place where Albert Einstein actually mathematically proved is where all the energy in the universe really is. It's all there in the zero-point field. But the zero-point field is a place where if you think of an ocean wave bobbing up and down, and you measure the bottom of the wave versus the top of the wave, which is say that's just the height of your wave. You measure the distance between the peak of one wave in the ocean and the peak of the other wave. That is called your wavelength. Imagine those wavelengths are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So the peaks on your waves are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And they eventually get to the wavelength and the wave height of light itself. And light itself is vibrating at wavelengths that are so small, you can't see them. But the higher the frequency that light gets, it gets so high in frequency that it passes what we can see. We can see the frequency of red light, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. We can see all those colors. Those are just frequencies of light. Red light is much lower in frequency than violet light. Violet light is super high in frequency. But higher than violet light is ultraviolet near, which is invisible to most human beings, ultraviolet far, ultraviolet extreme. Then you get to X-rays, which pass right through solid objects, and then you get to gamma rays, which are utterly deadly and super, super powerful. And then William Tiller at Stanford University, who's been studying consciousness and material science for over 30 years, he's in our film Quantum Communication, he determines that consciousness, which thought and emotion correspond with as consciousness, is operating at a wavelength higher in frequency than gamma rays. And the implications of this are so staggering. We can go there a little bit later. But basically, that gives you a picture of where wavelengths are going. And the zero-point energy field is beyond, is in that domain. It's in the domain of consciousness itself, actually. It's so high in frequency. The power scale of, you see, the way, let me just, you'll see, we're going to see, people, how all this ties into our spirituality, how science and spirituality are merging, and how science can be used as a tool to actually help us on our spiritual path, because we can use some of these technologies and these devices to not only improve our state of well-being and our state of meditation, but we can use devices to measure which meditations are actually really working for us and which aren't, which are really helping us and which are not. So to understand how light, we think of light as consciousness, the light of the mind, in William Tiller's formula, being beyond the gamma ray spectrum, totally invisible to all most human beings. And Einstein wins the Nobel Prize in physics from a great journey that starts with his godfather in quantum physics, which is the godfather of quantum physics, Max Planck. Max Planck, you know, won the Nobel Prize in physics back in early 1900s. I can look that up. And Max Planck, who won the Nobel Prize in physics, tells us that, and this is amazing that the world has not accepted what I'm about to tell everybody. He basically tells us that the universe itself is conscious. It's alive. It's not this dead place that's just electricity ruling everything. It's nothing like that at all. You know, he literally says that I can tell you, as a person who has studied, you know, the orbits of particles, subatomic particles and matter and as such, that mind is, I'm quoting him loosely here because I don't have the notes in front of me, mind is the matrix of all matter. Mind is the matrix of all matter. It's telling matter what to do. And for someone who won the Nobel Prize and is literally considered the godfather of quantum physics, it's a pretty remarkable statement that Planck is actually saying this. And he goes on and on about it quite a bit. And where it comes from is there were these great conferences in quantum physics and physics that were held in Europe every year. And they were called the Solvay Conference on Quantum Mechanics in Brussels, Belgium. This is called the fifth Solvay Conference on Quantum Mechanics at Brussels, Belgium. And what happens there is Niels Bohr, another physicist who eventually wins the Nobel Prize, and Heisenberg. Heisenberg is very famous now because of movies like What the Bleep Do We Know, which is about the mind and the observer effect, how the mind is affecting the observed. both of these scientists come to Einstein, and it says it looks like that whenever we're taking photographs of the quantum universe, whenever we're doing experiments on the quantum level, and that just means the atom and smaller. Quantum just means your quanta just comes from the word root word amount, quanta or amount, and the quantum is an amount. It's an area where scientists are studying the nature of the atom and smaller. And what they find is that the minds of the researchers are affecting the results of the experiment. In fact, in my film, Quantum Communication, an MIT physicist, Dr. Claude Swanson, states that they literally had to remove the minds of the researchers away from the experiment before they did the experiment because the minds of the researchers were messing up the results. So they knew this. They knew what Planck was saying. Max Planck, the godfather of quantum physics, is saying mind is the matrix of all matter. It's telling it what to do. But how is the brain doing this when the brain is only producing millivolts of electricity? It's the weakest system there is. Little thing is telling, you know, energy what to do and telling matter what to do. I mean, how could this be? But it was happening, and it was happening over and over and over again. And so what Einstein does is he's a patent clerk working, in fact, he's a college dropout. And it was Max Planck who takes an interest in Einstein and says, you know, this guy is out of the box. He doesn't have a PhD. He doesn't have any degree. He's not even a college graduate, but I like his ideas. And he gets him heard. He gets his papers heard that Einstein is writing in his spare time. And Einstein's papers eventually writes a paper that explains the photoelectric effect. And this is very important also in understanding how my pendants work. The photoelectric effect is the transference of photons, particles of light, electromagnetism, which spans from the radio spectrum all the way through the visible colors that we see in the rainbow spectrum, all the way into the invisible ultraviolet X-rays, gamma rays, and beyond. And Einstein explains how they transfer their energy when they hit a piece of metal, which is a conductor. A conductor is the material that when electromagnetism or light hits it, it causes the energy or the electrons inside of that material to flow. So picture a copper wire that's going into your blender out of the wall. Picture it like a river in your mind. And there's water flowing down the river, and when the water hits the paddle wheel, it spins, right? Well, your blender spins because electrons are like drops of water, and they're flowing through the wire at tremendous speed, and when they hit the paddle in the blender, basically everything starts spinning because of the way you've configured your magnets. It's just like water going through a wire. That's how electricity works. That's how everything works. Your light bulb, your computer, everything is because these little electrons are flowing around. What Einstein found is the frequency of the light determined how fast those electrons would flow. So a violet photon, when it hits a conductor, will cause the electron to move with more energy than a red photon. So we understand that now, that red light carries less energy than blue light or ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet carries more energy than violet light. And then X-rays will cause electrons to flow with more energy than visible light. And gamma radiation is so powerful that a 10-second burst of gamma radiation coming from a distant supernova will produce more energy than our sun will, than Earth's sun, in its multi-billion-year lifetime. Gamma radiation is that powerful. A 10-second burst from a distant supernova will produce more energy than our sun will in its multi-billion-year lifetime. And what's more amazing is quantum physicists have discovered that consciousness is operating on a frequency higher than gamma rays.
Mm.
How do they know this? They know it because, okay, let's take your cell phone, and this is going to be really easy for people to understand. Your cell phone is receiving information. Information is your voice traveling on a microwave, which is a little higher in frequency than radio waves. It's lower in frequency than the color red, and it's carrying your information, your voice, on that radio wave. And when you go down into a basement or you go into a parking garage, you lose reception, right? They drop out.
Mm-hmm.
That's because the material, the mountain of concrete in the building, is blocking the reception. Well, the higher the frequency of the radio wave, the more penetrating it is to material. So quantum physicists, major physicists at major universities in the United States, are doing experiments on consciousness and putting barriers in front of it, just like you do with your cell phone. And guess what they're finding? It goes through everything with no loss of signal. All of the experiments they've done, regardless of the material, it just goes right through, like it's not even there, which means its frequency is higher than all of the other frequencies we've studied so far, which we know we can block the signal of.
Which, higher than gamma rays.
Higher than gamma rays. And now when you go back to converting that higher frequency wavelength back into matter, consciousness has more power than a 10-second gamma ray burst, which is enough energy to destroy our entire sun with a breeze. So why aren't our brains super powerful, right? Why aren't we? Well, we don't realize they are. They're amazingly powerful.
So,
David,
theoretically, with just our brains, if we could find a way to harness this energy, we wouldn't need gas or electric energy. We could power our planet with our minds.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the proposals now, that the way super advanced extraterrestrials are powering their spacecraft, I mean, the most advanced ones are using mental power because it's so powerful that, you know, it can send you at multiples of the speed of light anywhere in the universe. It's non-physical energy. But what's amazing now is this is the order of things that we previously thought. I just met with a Harvard medical doctor last week who said, you know, in Harvard Medical School, book one is understanding the energy system of the body. If the energy system of the body is low, then the body is prone to disease and all sorts of problems. So when you're measuring voltage of the body, if the voltage is low, it's going to be prone to diseases and problems in the body. People with nervous system disorders I tested were really low in their voltage. So what I did with my pendants is I programmed not only the sound of the sun from NASA, but the 1.111111, which would eventually vibrate all the way down to the zero-point field and all the way to consciousness. I programmed that in the stones. And so when people held them, what we started to do now is we did aura camera photography before and after when a person's in contact with one of these. And my God, when we saw the results, I said, this has got to be fake. This can't be real. A little stone can't possibly be doing this to this woman's aura. But it was. We would see her aura before she touched the stone, and it had a lot of energy breaks in it, especially around her hips and her lower spine. As soon as she plugged into the stone pendant, her aura got way brighter. Not just a little bit brighter, but way brighter. And that's the part that I first found hard to believe. Because some people were saying, you know, this is a trick. The voltage is only increasing in the pendant itself. It's not really happening in the nervous system. And I said, well, the aura camera will tell us the truth. And when we saw the aura camera photography, in fact, not only did we use the GDV aura camera, which got numerical data, as well as, you know, showing us the alignment of the chakras, which is how centered the chakras are, improved dramatically with this pendant technology. And why is because when you increase the current or the conductivity of the body's energy, then it's going to become more coherent. The chakras are going to talk to each other better. So I started to have these epiphanies, like, why is it that you see the use of certain gemstones in the Bible? Why is, you know, the New Jerusalem all being described as, you know, buildings and made of certain types of crystal, Sardis stone and, you know, crystal and jasper and all these stones? Why was God's city made of crystal, and what was the purpose of it? And then you start to see India, you know, the use of gemstones in medicine. And you start to see the appearance of the use of gemstones in meditation, you know, placing a gemstone on the heart chakra or the third eye. So I realized that what the ancient masters did is they were able to program spiritual information in stone, not using technology like I'm using. They did it by sound, repeating mantras for perhaps a whole lifetime. And if you were to pick up the rosary of a you know, great Catholic saint like Saint Teresa and touch her rosary, you could have a mystical experience. And we know from sources close to the Dalai Lama that in Tibet, there are these caves where literally, this is one of the greatest guarded secrets in Tibetan mysticism, where Buddhas of the past transferred their spiritual energy, a great portion of it, in these stone statues that were replicas of that master. And the statues are guarded so carefully today that if it is said that if someone actually touched one of them, they could, if they weren't ready, it would be too powerful for them and knock them out. I mean, but we don't just have stories like that in Tibet. We have stories like that in Egypt. We have stories like that in a lot of places. And then we go back to studying the great stone masonry masters, the great masters of stone. And this is really interesting because there I am, I'm lecturing at a UFO Congress, and I've got a lineup of people that I'm voltmeter testing with my pendants. And this man comes up to me, and he says, I'm a 33-degree stonemason. And I said, that's the highest degree of stonemasonry, master. And he said, I want to talk to you. And I said, well, I'm so busy right now. And I said, I really do want to talk to you. He said, you figured out a secret about the stones. And I said, I know. I said, I know I figured out the secret. And it's not just the secret of programming any old information in the stone. I figured out a great number of different harmonic codes of the universe, very proprietary codes of the universe, and I've identified them mathematically. And I'm only beginning to program the stones with what I'm doing right now. And
so, David, I want to ask you about the difference, because what I've been seeing is that there are some stones on the market and wands and things, and some are being sold even as multi-level marketing. And from, I don't want to contradict what other people believe, but from my experience, my own observation and experience, I haven't seen any results that these companies are claiming. And so I'm wondering, what's the difference between your crystals and perhaps other people's crystals?
Well, see, I wasn't the first one to, I really think this all started with Marcel Vogel at IBM, and I wasn't the first one to come up with the idea. There are a lot of people that are just, you know, mentally projecting thoughts into their crystals and selling them. There are people that claim to have pendants that raise your energy, and I've tested them on the voltmeter, and they do absolutely nothing. There are really a lot of scams out there. I am the only one who has a pendant that tests really positively on a voltmeter. There are people that can do aura camera photography, but it's hard for people to trust and say, you know, how do I know they didn't just make that up? That's why, if you understand a light bulb, if you put more energy in a light bulb, it gets brighter. So if your energy goes up in your nervous system, your light bulb, the biophotons, which are measured by German scientist Fritz Albert Popp, he's actually proved the existence of biophotons, that every living thing from a flower to a plant to an animal, a mammal, or a human is emitting light. And he proved that that light is carrying intelligent information. So, and then different organisms or different life forms have different millivolts in their systems. I mean, you can even plug a voltmeter into an apple and measure the voltage of the apple itself. So everything has energy that's alive. Everything that's alive has energy. So to see an increase of energy on the voltmeter means there really is more energy, and it makes perfect sense that the light bulb of the body is going to get brighter, because that's how science works. So if we want to brighten our aura, I like to tell people kind of this simile like this, that use this pendant, I mean, wear it around your heart, because your heart produces electromagnetic energy, and that's where most of the light in the body is coming from. If you take a pair of night vision goggles, which you can get at Walmart, and in the middle of the night, stand fairly close to your neighbor or your friend and point your night vision at their heart. It's so bright, it burns your eyes. That's how much light is coming out of our heart chakra. So the idea is that, let's look at, okay, you asked the question about other ones out there. You know, I'm not going to name names and do name bashing, but
I don't want to do that either. I just want to protect.
I've tested a lot of things out there, and they don't work. Now, there are some that do work, but I am the first person to discover harmonic codes. There's nobody prior to Leonardo Fibonacci who discovered the Fibonacci sequence, and the golden mean was actually Archimedes, his predecessor. They discovered the golden mean. The golden mean is valuable. It is in nature. but it's not as in many places as the 1.11111 is. I've had so many experiences with the 1.11111, I can't even tell you. I mean, when I'm in the lab and I'm treating these pendants, my brain starts to produce a lot of pleasure. I mean, not spiritual bliss, but physical pleasure. And it's so strong sometimes when I come out of the lab, I'm sitting in front of my computer and I can't even touch the keys because my whole nervous system is just bathed in this pleasure. Now, I can't use that as a device because it's not FDA approved. It's not a medical device. It's an experimental device. But the stones themselves, the pendants, have no radiation. They have no energy. I have nuclear radiation meters here, so they're not radioactive. That's not what's going on. They have information inside of them, no electricity. Now, here's what quantum physicists are discovering and what my secret Harvard medical doctor told me about what's going on at Harvard Medical School is that quantum physicists are starting to study with medical doctors, and this has never happened before because the new medicine, the new interest in vibrational medicine is that quantum physicists are going to be teaching medical doctors what they know, and the secret transformation is already beginning inside of our major universities all over the world, that vibrational medicine is the wave of the future. What quantum physicists are telling medicine doctors is, we previously thought, as you did, that energy is the boss. Energy tells biology what to do, because that's what science has told us all along. Energy flowing through your copper wires like water down a river tells your blender to spin, right? Because it's just like water spinning on a spinning paddle. But what they're finding now is something far different. Information tells energy what to do. Information is the same as our voices are riding on a radio wave. The radio wave is the energy. The voice is the information, you see? So the information tells the energy what to do, then the energy with the information tells matter or biology what to do. So why is it that when you cut your hand, your body immediately gets information that tells the energy system of the body to send, you know, white blood cells and go repair the damage on that location? You see, it's information that's telling the energy system to go repair the damage. So when you look at what is a harmonic body versus a disharmonic body. Well, electronically, with all the cell phones, all the satellites, all the television broadcasts, and working in buildings that are insulated and wearing rubber shoes, we are out of phase. We've lost our harmony. Why is it that if you sit down and you chant the mantra Om for 30 minutes or you practice meditation for an hour, you feel so much better? Why? Because you are reharmonizing your nervous system and your energy system. But even better than that, you're harmonizing your information. You see, consciousness is even more subtle than information. Consciousness has the ability to either be organized or disorganized. And what we're finding by using these scientific tools like the GDV Aura camera to interface with spiritual techniques and practices is which meditation really affected you the most. Well, for me, it was the two-hour sitting meditation. For my wife, she's a singer. She's a jazz singer. So she resonated with chanting the mantra Om for an hour, 45 minutes. And that's the one that gave her the highest experience because she resonates with sound. And so it's really interesting. So we have all these practices that all these masters are telling us to do, but you know, my experience of practicing meditation every day, I mean, I don't miss a day for 30 years, and I've sat 12 hours a day, 6 hours a day, 4 hours a day at different times of my life, and now about 45 minutes a day, and sometimes I do more than, I do one full, vigorous 45-minute breathing session per week. I've been doing that for a year now. So I do a lot of techniques that I've done over the years. But what I found, you know, as a meditator, because for me, you know, here I am talking about science and, you know, spiritual technology and a little gadgets. Those things can improve your state. They can help you, but they're not God. You really are, you know, when you become realized, you become God realized. You become a cell of God consciousness. And you are either in phase with the harmony of the universe or you're out of phase with the harmony of the universe. all of our electrical devices and our pollution and our noise pollution puts our bodies and our minds out of phase. And you can see this on the Aura machine. You'll see all the chakras are all scattered. They're not in a perfect straight line. They're not in a nice little tight little waveform. They're scattered all over the place, but when you use the pendant or you do 2 hours of meditation, they suddenly become aligned. They become aligned because they're more coherent, because they're talking to each other better. Now, this is where it gets really amazing, is when we ask the question, why, if consciousness is the greatest power in the universe, and it could ultimately power a spacecraft, what William Tiller at Stanford, 30 years of research, found is the reason consciousness isn't that powerful for most of us is because it's not coherent. It's not coherent. It's not organized. I'll give you an example. The law of attraction, everybody knows about the law of manifestation, what you think comes into being. This is a really great experiment William Tiller did, and it's in my film, Quantum Communication, for those of you who want to see it. They took meditators, and then they took a sample of water. And water naturally has, depending on its source, a certain pH balance, which means potential hydrogen. So, you know, rainwater might have a pH of 5.5, and tap water might be a pH of 7. So what he did is he wanted to use mental telepathy to try to change the pH of the water by a full pH unit, which is almost impossible. This is a physical manifestation of consciousness. This isn't just telepathy saying, I received your thought and you were thinking of a blue square. This is actually physically affecting the material property of a substance at a distance. And what they did, this experiment over and over and over, what I'm about to tell you, hundreds of times, and they did it as far away as over 6,000 miles from the water, the glass of water, and the subject. But what William Tiller found is that it was really hard to get a good meditator who could hold a coherency for the amount of time they needed to affect the water's pH, to either tell it to go up or down. So they put a perfect human intention and they trapped it in an electrochemical device called an IIED. So this was an example of actually trapping consciousness in a physical material. It was actually fruit fly larvae. It was part of the material that they used. And when they trapped it in this device, which was the instructions for the pH of the water to go up a full pH unit, in 30 days, the water went up a full pH unit every time. And just to be sure it wasn't nature that was raising the pH unit, they decided to tell the pH to go down a full pH unit. And sure enough, even through solid, you know, rock and material, the pH of the water went down every time. That's incredible.
It is, and we have some callers that have been sitting on the line waiting super patiently, and I'm just wondering if you're ready to take a call.
Yeah, let's take a call. Let me just finish my thought here, and then we can,
sure,
can do that, because I don't want to lose where I'm thinking here. So once Tiller had done that, he put consciousness, he's not even using technology, and he did it over and over and over again. What he proved is that consciousness, when it's coherent, always produced results. Now, what do? We say, I want to manifest this person in my life. And then all of a sudden, we, you know, 3 days later, we go, oh, no, I don't want them. I want this person. I don't really believe I can get that person. They're not interested in me. You see, that's called incoherent. Mm-hmm. But you see, nature is very responsive to consciousness, but it's also very patient. Well, consciousness may be more powerful than gamma radiation. A sun and a star is not born in a day. In fact, it takes billions of years. The consciousness is organizing and telling the sun to be and the earth to be was very, very patient. And it was very consistent. It's very, very consistent, like a perfect meditator, which William Tiller couldn't find, so he had to put the perfect intention in fruit fly larvae. Well, one more experiment before we take the call. A PhD in physics and an MD at University of California in Irvine, Dr. Joel Jones, did this experiment. First, he took petri dishes of human cells and he exposed them to a lethal dose of gamma radiation. Gamma radiation is the most harmful thing you could possibly do to a cell. It is utterly, it kills the cells in 48 hours. So because he knows it's so deadly, there's no way that by chance that the cells were going to survive, he decided to use pranic healers. Pranic healers do this deep breathing meditation, and then they focus their intention after the breathing on healing. And the pranic healers would do healing intention to the human cells before radiation, before they expose them to radiation, after radiation, before and after radiation, and then with a karmic gift, which is where the healer actually donates some money on his credit card to a cause. It's a really incredible experiment. And again, you know, these scientists at these major universities do this over and over and over again to rule out chance. And I actually spoke to Dr. Joy Jones, and I'm very, very excited about what he's doing. So the results were, first, I had to back up. They had to condition the space or the room where the experiment was going to take place with meditation. And if they didn't condition the space of the room, none of the intentional work would happen. None of it would all fail. But every time, once you condition the space, which is removing all the negativity in that room, and then you do the healing work. This is a key secret for people who are doing healing work, is the room that you do the healing in has to be pure. The experiment showed that the cells that were exposed to a deadly dose of gamma radiation, the pranic healing intentions were able to increase the lifespan of the cell by as much as 48%. The one that healed the most was the one with before and after healing, before and after gamma radiation, and donating money to a cause with compassion, a cause that the healer actually believed in and resonated with. That produced the highest healing results, just a little bit higher than healing before and after radiation. But then Dr. Joy Jones decided to do something even more amazing. He put the healing intentions in crystal mineral solution, a material physical solution. He just had the pranic healers do intentional work with a solution. And no matter how far that solution traveled, every time they put it on the cell before and after gamma radiation, the cells lived 48% longer. Every time. Now that shows you that crystal is programmable, even with consciousness, if it's really, really powerful. And it stays there and it produces verifiable results at the university level. I mean, this should make headlines all over the world. I was so excited when I read his results, I decided to track him down and call him up, and sure enough, it really did happen. It wasn't a rumor, and he really was doing this work, and I used to work over at University of California at Irvine on the non-radioactive nuclear energy. We knew a lot of the same scientists, and I said to him, you know, how come the rest of the physics community isn't in a roar over this? I mean, this is a major, major discovery that you're able to do this. And he said that they don't even know about it. He said because the ridicule factor in the peer review system is so bad that he'd rather just do research and see who finds out about it. So, you know, with that amazing discovery, I realized even more I trusted what was happening in my pendants, that the information was really there. It was really, really there. And there's more and more very specific information that I can do there. We've had a lot of amazing stories from people with pendants, but I'm not allowed to talk about them because I'm not allowed to make any claims. That's, you know, unfortunately the way the law works. But we can take some calls.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much. And it's been an awesome hour. So let's take a couple calls, and then maybe we'll take a quick break after that. So from area code 804.
Good. Fascinating show.
Hi.
I'm just a simple individual, but I trained my mind to think in unlimited terms, and I'm trying to unleash a whole new form of global incentive economy based upon a self-taught expertise that I term creative utilization of information. It's a very powerful concept, and I've had some bizarre experiences over my life where I even was written up in a front-page Wall Street Journal article based on some of this stuff. I exposed a former federal government bureaucrat for fraud. But I want to ask if you are familiar with or know of Dr. David and LightParty.com?
I've heard of it, and I definitely have heard of it, but I'm not, you know, well versed in it.
Well, he's a former presidential candidate. He's also the founder and director of the San Francisco Medical Research Foundation, which has all kinds of holistic medical information. He's got another company called Artainment, where he has all kinds of beautiful kaleidoscopic images with music that are actually therapeutic and mind-opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
I've heard of the Light Party, yeah.
Yes, there is a little blog, if I can give you just to take a look at it. I'm trying to find somebody to get a bead on helping me get out of my head the things. I've had the UFO paranormal and near-death experience, and there is a blog that has a letter from President Obama to me and also an interview and some brief information related to cyberspace. If you Google creativity, the number 777.com, that would bring it up. But I wanted to just, if I may, I'll close with a quick poem that I authored that sort of encompasses some of the things that you're talking about. And it's titled Mine Your Mind, M-I-N-E or M-I-N-D. And it goes, mine your mind, and you may find new gems to be discovered and uncovered. The cure for illness and the end of poverty are just two examples of what may come when someone minds their mind. Perhaps that someone is you. Ask God to guide you and you will see unlimited possibilities and opportunities. Be kind as you open your mind and you will learn to care and share. Once you become aware, you can change this world through love and understanding. It's not too late, but don't hesitate, for today is tomorrow and tomorrow never comes. At the end of your days, will you be in a haze or give a bequest to the rest? A poem, an invention, or a solution to pollution are awaiting to be mined. It's all up to you to mine your mind and help in the betterment of all mankind. Good luck, and may God bless you.
Great. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank
you.
Very
nice.
I'll just stay on and listen, if I may.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And again, what was that website?
It's creativity37.com, creativity777.com.
Great. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you.
Okay. And so we had someone else from the area code 305 calling, but I see your hand is no longer up. So if you are calling in, the number is 1-347-202-0129. And if you do want to get on the air, please do press 1 so that your hand goes up. Okay, there we go. So area code 305, you're on the air.
Thank you. Namaste. I have very much enjoyed the show. At one point I lost audio, but I called back in. I'm really amazed and without any words, just enjoying my listening experience. It's just wonderful. Regarding your last caller, we cannot tell others what to do, so it's like mind my mind. And I was wondering, since I do sometimes design jewelry, but, you know, out of regular stones, and I did try to go into your website yesterday. I only saw 3. I was wondering if you were going to make any other jewelry that is less showy and more the kind that is discreetly worn, if you know what I mean, and I hope you don't take it as offensive.
Well, many of us have different styles that we like, and I can actually, you know, custom treat any piece of jewelry as long as it has some crystal material, you know, even diamonds. And diamonds actually are the highest vibrational stone to treat. So you can go through our website there if you're interested in having something custom done.
I saw only 3, and it said the website was
there's actually a whole e-book. If you go to lightstreamtechnologies.com, there's a whole e-book there with over 100 pages, and there's a lot more than 3. It's not actually a site because we don't have the website built. It's just a link to the ebook. If you look for the link, there's a little thing you click on the website, and you can actually see the whole ebook there.
And
it has the whole story is in the ebook.
And that is there actually is a link up to Lightstream Technologies at the Blog Talk Radio page here, as well as to David's site, Voice Entertainment. So, David, you're saying that if someone has like a special diamond ring or jewelry that they have created, they can contact you and work out.
Oh yeah, we can. As long as it's not just plain metal. I haven't tested a plain piece of like a gold, you know, band or silver by itself, and it's not that I don't think it could work with just a metal piece of jewelry, but I haven't seen and done enough testing there yet. I don't just do something theoretically. I like to see real test data. I have never seen a piece of plain metal, because metal itself, the human body electricity can't move through it. It's not strong enough. So it's really hard to share information, whereas any crystal or diamond or gemstone, it can.
Okay, so it could.
That's, yeah.
If someone's just making crystal jewelry out of stones they're getting off eBay, like that's enough as long as it's genuine.
Well, it could be a ring with a gemstone in it. It could be even a pair of earrings. But it's fairly expensive to have this done. I mean, the most expensive part of our process is the generators that do this. So it's not terribly expensive. I'm just telling you it ranges depending on what they're going to send me. It could range anywhere from $150 for one piece to $300 or $400, depending on the piece.
Okay. So, caller, does that answer your question?
It answers my question, yeah. I just like smaller things because people come in different sizes. And because I do this, I thought, well, how beautiful. I took down your name and all the information yesterday, and I thought I'm going to listen to what you have to say, and it's been more interesting than what I thought it would be.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
well,
we're actually now, in addition to the harmonics, we're putting, for example, the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, Hindu prayers, Buddhist prayers. We can actually put the prayers of a certain religion custom for a person. So if a person wanted an ancient Jewish prayer, if they provided me an audio file of that prayer that was really pristine in quality, I can run it through the generators and convert it into the kind of energy that we put into the stone. So, but if someone wants something custom with their own particular prayer that they supply, it costs more.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for calling in. And that answers your question, right, caller?
I appreciate you taking the call. I thank you, and I'll keep on listening.
All right.
Namaste to you.
Namaste. Have a great day. So if you'd like to get on the air and ask a question, the number is 347-202-0129. We're speaking with David Sarita. He is a filmmaker, an author, an actor, and he's been studying quantum physics for well over a decade, right?
Oh, yeah. The quantum physics part of it and engineering has well over a decade. I've been mainly practicing meditation and doing environmental work for 30 years now. I'm 49 years old this month.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
Someone, my key heart is asking, how long of a process is it to energize these stones or pendants?
They go through five generators, and it takes an hour or more. So if I just did one piece, the technology was all, the electronics don't exist. You can't buy them in a store, so I had to hand make a lot of the electrical components. So it was, you know, it was fairly expensive to do it. It took us a year of selling pendants just to break even on the lab and the materials. So we did, and it seems to be very popular and very trendy out there to have your own vibrational jewelry. So it's growing. It's a whole new concept, you know, harmonic. I'm actually expanding beyond the jewelry line. I'm going to be doing new harmonic appliances. For example, the hairdryer is the most deadly appliance. I would never use one, especially after the scientific testing we did. It radiates more than any appliance we use, and we point it directly at our head and our chest. And I believe it over time can contribute to cancer. I can't prove that as far as the way the government wants you to prove things, but when you see how much a hairdryer radiates and you point it at your head and you're actually holding your hand on the end of the plug line, I can show you on aura camera photography, it's utterly destructive to the human body. And I think a lot of women use their hair dryers a lot, and it could even contribute to breast cancer. When I worked for high energy micro devices, I was president of the company, did all the military communication. We were dealing with a lot of different government agencies, and I got to know a scientist who worked on the Manhattan Project, which was the development of the nuclear bomb. His name is John Goffman. He was a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's the only scientist in the Manhattan Project who actually proved and went against the government, who hired him to test the human health effects of ionizing radiation. And this would include hair dryers, cell phones, and computers, and all these sort of things. And he pretty much proved that X-rays were causing breast cancer in women. So when women were going to get mammographies, they were being exposed to X-rays and contributing to breast cancer, definitely. And also, when we go to the dentist's office, when the dentist tells you that, oh, it's just like sitting out in the sun and it's really not going to hurt you, they're pointing an X-ray at your head when they're doing dental X-rays. So I'd highly recommend getting the new digital X-rays for if you go to a dentist, make sure they have the new digital ones because they're much lower dose. John Goffman told me all of his data pretty much proved this, but the American Medical Association, they were really on a rampage against his movement because he was basically, you know, saying that their medical equipment was dangerous, and radiation therapy for cancer certainly was very, very dangerous. And so all John Goffman wanted to do, you know, was convince people to have lower dose radiation medical equipment so that people would be, you know, not exposed as much as they are. So, you know, with that, the whole movement now in understanding what causes harm in an electromagnetic wave or an X-ray is not really so much the frequency as it is how harmonized the information is. So when I looked at the hairdryer, I thought, you know, it's nowhere near as much radiation as an X-ray, but it's continuous, and you blow dry your hair for half an hour sometimes. Doing it every day, and over long extended use, you're going to have theoretically hair loss and possibly frying your brain cells. So I've actually come up with a hairdryer that not only doesn't radiate at all, I've tested materials, very exotic materials that the hairdryer is going to be made of that block all the radiation. Absolutely. I have an electromagnetic field meter in my house. And then, in addition to blocking all the radiation, they're going to reshape the electricity so that it's actually harmonic information that it's vibrating towards your head. So that's kind of where I'm going next.
Wow. So not only will it not be harmful, it'll actually be somewhat healing.
Yeah, I mean, it will have the harmonic 1.111 in it, and then we're going to do a blender that puts a harmonic beam of information into your smoothie.
Mm.
So I'm not very impressed with the blender world out there right now. Blenders put off a huge field. If you get a little electromagnetic field meter and you hold it next to your appliances, you can find out where the safety zones are. Cell phone, I'm actually coming out with these pads that block radiation for your laptop computer, but also if your cell phone, only use it on speaker mode, and as long as you're about a foot and a half away, you're okay. My electromagnetic field meter on my cell phone, the radiation falls off really fast at a distance, but when you're holding it to your head, it's over 8 milligauss. And my Harvard medical doctor tells me that on the inside, anything above 1.8 milligauss is harmful.
And so what about Bluetooth? Because that's right sitting on your head all day long.
I haven't tested the Bluetooth. I should. At this point, I could say it's probably putting off a field. Whether it's above 1.8 milligauss, I don't know, but it's really easy. You can go on Amazon. You can get a cheap EMF meter, or you get a good one like I have for $100, and believe me, it's worth $100, because you can pretty much, like for example, where you sleep, if you have electrical outlets near your headboard, move. Don't sleep next to an electrical outlet. If you hold your EMF meter near them, they radiate quite a bit, way over.
So how close are we talking about here?
I wouldn't be 3 feet away from an electrical outlet. I wouldn't. I think a foot and a half, it starts to fall off. Well, actually, let me go get my meter. Just give me 1 second, and I'm going to hold it or not wet, and
sure.
I'll tell you.
So David's going to get his EMF reader to see how what kind of electrical charge is coming out of just the wall socket. You may have one in your bedroom right next to your head. I know I do. I've got a little lamp and all of that beside my bed, and so my head is within 2 feet from an electrical outlet. So he'll be back in just a minute. And again, if you want more information, oh hi, you're back.
Yeah, 3 feet. Don't sleep closer than 3 feet to an outlet.
Okay, and someone's saying, yeah, most bedrooms have an outlet in every wall.
I know it's. Let me give you some. This is inside information. It's very deep. The Electric Power Research Institute in the United States. You can search EPRI online, and there are studies if you want. They did studies on the human health effects of ionizing radiation, like John Goffman did, but they were studying much lower doses, which is, you know, the fields of appliances in your house. And what they found was, you know, firstly, if you live near high-tension power lines, and you're not high-tension power lines are not the little telephone poles in the neighborhood. They're the big ones. And a friend of mine who lives in Redondo Beach, California, his wife got cancer, and his son developed a disease where as he was growing, his chest bones were caving in on his heart, and he had to get surgery. And so I asked him to check the background radiation in his house. So he called the power company. They came to his house. The background radiation everywhere in the house was 6 milligauss. Anything above 1.8 is harmful. My house is zero where I live. Of course, I'm in Sedona, Arizona. It's zero. That's the background. You really don't even want to have a background of 1 because it's continuous in your house. And what the power company told him is his house, with the ground, it's called the ground of your house, the grounding of the electrical system was not done properly by the builders and the electrician. And when your house isn't grounded, your appliances and your wires and your walls are radiating even more than normal. Very, very harmful stuff. And another person I know in Phoenix, his wife died of cancer, and he didn't. And I said, check the background radiation in your house. His house is 8 milligauss in the background. Deadly, deadly house. Mm-hmm. I said, get out of there or get the house properly grounded. And his kids developed serious problems. So when the Electric Power Research Institute did these studies, and they've done them for years, and you can see the reports online, they found that certain children living near these high energy fields would develop cancers and others didn't. And because not all of them did, as well as elderly people, developed even things, I hate to say it, but they've done studies on Parkinson's disease in these fields. And they would see cases, and then they would see no cases. So I met with recently a scientist who worked at Motorola for 20 years, and he knew the answer, why some people got cancer and didn't. And when he told me, I went, oh, my God, I mean, that's what everybody's looking for to prove this, because the Electric Power Research Institute could not admit that high-tension power lines and high EMF backgrounds in homes was causing cancer because it wasn't uniform. It didn't affect everybody in the building. And what this scientist at Motorola found is that everyone's bodies, depending on what you eat and your water supply, have different amounts of toxic heavy metals in their body. Some people have mercury and lead in unacceptable levels in their body. And when mercury or lead are in your body and you're in the presence of a strong magnetic field, it ionizes, which means it gives off charged particles out of the material. And a lead ion and a mercury ion are deadly, deadly. Now, another person might not have as much mercury or lead in their body, or the chemistry in their body doesn't allow their body to trap the excessive amounts of lead and mercury and some other heavy metals. And so they don't get ionization, so therefore they don't get the cancer. And that's the answer that Electric Power Research Institute never figured out. They never went inside of the body and looked at the cases of the levels of heavy metals inside of the body. So that's a whole other area of human health, is to remove heavy metals from your body. If you remove them, you'll be in a much better state. In fact, this Harvard medical doctor I know, that's part of what he's doing right now is teaching people how to remove their heavy metals using chelation methods and probiotics and things like that to get rid of the heavy metals.
So, David, Ohio Exopolitics wants to know, how do you test the background radiation of your house?
You get an electromagnetic field meter. I have one. It's the one I have in front of me is by Lutron, L-U-T-R-O-N. And you can get it on Amazon for $100. And these things are really good to have because we work with computers and cell phones. The first setting measures up to 200 milligauss, and you really don't need to measure higher than that. If it's higher than that, you need to run and get out of there because you'll never be able to block more than 200 milligauss. There are three settings on the meter. So the first setting, just go around your house and go near your power outlets, and you'll be amazed at your cordless phone how bad it is. It's really something you shouldn't use, in my opinion, even though we have one here. I'm on a landline right now, so things don't radiate at all. And just stand in the middle of the room where there's no outlets and measure the levels. If you see if you see 1.8 milligauss or higher in the background, if you're even 1 milligauss in the background steady, that's not good, in my opinion, because that's every day, all day. And what you need to do is contact an electrician to make to reground your house. What causes the excessive radiation, either you're living in Manhattan and there's a lot of electrical activity in the whole building, and the whole building isn't grounded if you're in an apartment building or you're in a high-rise at work, or there's just too much electrical activity going on in general and there's not much you can do about it. I am going to be coming out with, on my website at whitestreamtechnologies.com, little pads for your laptop, because when you're sitting on your laptop is on your lap, you're basically radiating your lap. And pregnant women, men, nobody should be getting even low doses of EMF radiation in that area of the body. In fact, any area of the body. So I can block the whole field.
And that's with the electro...
Well, I haven't come out with that product yet, but it's going to be very soon. I've tested a number of different exotic materials, and I found the winner, the one that blocks everything. So I can do it. I can make these. And they'll be very affordable. They're not going to be very expensive.
And Ohio Exopolitics is asking, I think, about the EMF monitor. What's the name of it again that you use?
It's a Lutron. L-U-T-R-O-N. EMF 23 model.
Great. Thank you so much. And if you missed that, you can always listen to the podcast. So, David, how do you feel about taking a two-minute break?
Yeah.
Sound good? Okay. So I'm going to just put you on hold here. We are speaking with David Sarita. You can find him at lightstreamtechnologies.com or voiceentertainment.net. And if you've missed any of this show, you can always go back and listen to the podcast. That is the beauty of internet radio. So we'll be back with more Namaste Radio in about 2 to 3 minutes. I'm going to play a song called Brand New World. This was inspired by Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth. So we'll see you in a couple minutes.
There's a new wind blowing across the earth. It's bringing with it a brand new birth. The lamb and the lion will lay down side by side. They will live together in a brand
Welcome back to Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we're speaking today with David Sarita. You can find him online at lightstreamtechnologies.com and voiceentertainment.net. And, of course, if you're interested in learning more about Namaste Publishing, which is the creator of this show, Namaste Radio, you can go to their website, namastepublishing.com, where we have a global community website where there's lots of author blogs. Namaste Publishing is the original publisher of Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, so there's lots of information about Eckhart there, as well as a multitude of just so much information and spiritual information from Namaste's authors. There are blogs, there are chat rooms and forums that you can get involved in. So if you're interested in that, go to namastepublishing.com. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thanks. Good to be back here. So where, you know, do we want to go into singularity?
Yes, let's do that. First, quickly, I think my key heart is asking about the device for the laptop blocking the...
Yeah, I will. If you check at lightstreamtechnologies.com or email davidsarita@hotmail.com, I can get one of those made for you. It really, I'm going to make a little video that shows with the EMF meter, it blocks all the radiation from your laptop to zero. And it's non-toxic, and I just need to get a bunch of them made because I've tested about 10 or 15 different types of exotic materials, and most metals do not block fields at all. I mean, there's nothing you can do. You can't block it. But I found one that does, so I'm going to actually make them, have them custom made for laptops. And you can also set your cell phone, like when you're sitting on your lap on an airplane or sitting in your car or you're sitting at a coffee shop or even in front of your desk and you set your cell phone down, it's still radiating right through the wood table, right through the metal table. But if you put one of these pads down, it will block all the radiation. So just write me at davidsarita@hotmail.com. That's David, S-E-R-E-D-A, @hotmail.com.
Awesome. Okay, so let's talk about singularity.
Well, you know, this is really an amazing subject, and I want to give some background of where this major discovery and merging the highest teachings of non-dualism and many of the world's great religions, and also the greatest discovery in quantum physics, how I married the two of them together. But the background really starts is where I actually, you know, got this information from and how I was able to put it all together. Is first, you know, I grew up in, you know, I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada in 1961. Four brothers, we're all a year apart, and my dad moved our whole family, my mom, Wenda, and I, and Lynn Sarita, we all moved to Berkeley, California in 1964, and my dad was getting his PhD in psychology at the university there in the 60s, and this is in the middle of, you know, all the Vietnam War protests, and I remember the tear gas riots in Berkeley in those days. And running around with my mom and hiding us under benches and stuff, and the tear gas was burning our eyes so bad we couldn't even walk. And, you know, that was what had happened to our family. I mean, we were down there, and my dad was studying a lot of Far Eastern ideas. He was getting his PhD studying the super learning and healing effects of meditation and deep relaxation. That's how he actually got his PhD. And, you know, I was walking home from elementary school one day, and I went to Albany Elementary School. It's called Cornell Elementary School. And there was a flying saucer in the sky, clear as day, just sitting there and shimmering, and people were pounding on the neighbors' doors. Everyone was in a pandemonium. Everybody saw this thing. And it was, you know, I didn't know at that age. I was only 7 years old in 1968. But I was a Star Trek fan, and I was like, wow, that looks like the Starship Enterprise up there. And there's no fighter jets. There's nobody, you know, intercepting it. And I built model airplanes as a little kid, and I thought, you know, this thing is nothing like anything I've ever built. It's not an airplane. There's no wings. You can see a little dome on top of it. It's close enough that you can really see it. It's not the Goodyear blimp. I mean, it's nothing like that. And the streets were crowded with the people, and after 20 minutes, the thing just blinked out, disappeared, and it was gone. And from that day forward, I started to have visions. I was visited by beings from the Palladian star system who were teaching me about the craft and how it worked, and how inside of the craft I could see a set of lights going clockwise and another set of lights going counterclockwise right on top of it.
Wow.
Well, you know, that day messed up my whole life. My father's a PhD. My mom is an attorney in California. My uncle's a superior court judge in Ottawa, Brian Trafford. And my family is full of really highly educated people, but I couldn't do it. I just couldn't go down that road. I started to go through school deeper and deeper, and I just said, no, you people don't have the answers to what I'm looking for in my life. I want to know how beings can travel faster than light from one part of the universe to another. I want to know how to meditate and reach this state called enlightenment. So what I did is I didn't go down the road that my family went down, and I suffered dearly for it financially. I became a tree planter in British Columbia, and over 22 years I had planted 1.3 million trees or so.
Wow.
And I wanted to devote my life to my spiritual practice and my meditation practice, and I wanted to meet God. I wanted to have the experience of God. And I started doing a very deep Buddhist practice. Even though our family, we were all baptized Catholic, none of us practiced the Catholic religion at all. In fact, my dad never spoke about it much. He was mostly interested in meditation. So my meditation was very, very Buddhist. I did a lot of breathing meditations, and I did rigorously every day. And I remember some years sitting in my apartment in Vancouver, Canada, for 4 hours a day in the sitting practice and getting really high and getting really cosmically, you know, vibrated into higher and higher states. And I studied with a number of different meditation masters. I started with a meditation master from India. My father would introduce us to all of his sons who had retreats in Oyama, British Columbia. His name is Baba Haridas. And to this day, Baba Haridas, to me, is one of the most deeply enlightened masters on the planet. But what started to happen is, you know, studying with different masters, and met the Dalai Lama, went to India in 1996, you know, studied with Poonjaji there, met Mother Mira is actually my favorite master in the body, you know, today. I've met Kirpal Singh, Takar Singh, Amma. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I mean, all of the yogis and masters that people are familiar with, you know, from the Far East and West, I've probably met. I've met Krishnamurti, Osho, Rajneesh, I lived with for 1 year. And all of these beings are really, really incredible. But what I'm about to tell you just literally knocked my socks off. In 1994, I had a company, you know, every year I would plant trees in British Columbia and then go back to Los Angeles and try to manifest, you know, funding for non-radioactive nuclear energy and working with all these, you know, physicists. And we always failed. We never really got the money we needed to develop these technologies, even though we had Nobel Prize-winning signatures. And I developed this company called Green and Blue Corporation, which I envisioned one day planting trees on the hillside to give, you know, create funding sources for technologies, hydrogen fuel cell breakthroughs. And this was all in the 1980s, oil spill cleanup technologies and non-radioactive nuclear energy. I couldn't get funding for any of the projects. I literally met in person some of the richest people in the world. And I'm not going to name them because it's almost embarrassing to them that none of them did anything for the environment at all. And many of these scientists I represented have died at this point, and some of them have not. And they died with their inventions never being fulfilled. And so what happened in 1994 is the Canadian government decided to fine me for back taxes I owed. I forgot to pay about $1,000. They wiped out my entire tree planting right out of my bank account, which was like $12,000 in the end. I had nothing to live on, nowhere to live, and didn't have my job anymore at High Energy Micro Devices on the landmine and bomb detection because that company failed. And even though we were funded by Department of Defense and we could find landmines better than anybody else, there was no interest from the Princess Diana Land Fund. Nobody wanted to help us. after we completed our defense contract. And so I was destitute and nowhere to live, no money, exhausted from 4 or 5 months of tree planting, and the government stole all my money out of my bank account for a fine. And I didn't know how I was going to live. And so my dad had a ranch in Topanga, California, with horses and his wife, and their house was being renovated. I pitched my tent in the yard. I was so depressed at what had happened to my wife. My dream company had failed. Nothing, not a penny to my name. And flash floods came. Severe rainstorms came in October 94 and flooded my tent. I mean, just buried it with water. And I was, my briefcase with all my my business notes were floating around. I had a BMW convertible, brand new, parked in the mud next to the horses. And that's all I had is my car and the end of my business. And I mean, really thrown to the bottom of the universe. And my meditation practice was very Buddhist. And all of a sudden, I'm lying there freezing to death, and I'm floating in the water. Everything has got about 6 inches of water in it, and I'm getting hypothermia. And I should have gone in the house and got warm, and I didn't. I just said, you know, I've had it. You know, God, take me. Just take me. I'm done. And I took the covers off my body, which were all completely covered in water, which is soaking wet and freezing. And I started floating out of my body. And when I floated above my body, I hovered above the oak trees and the pouring rain in the dark, and it was, you know, maybe an hour before sunrise, so there was a hint of white in the dark clouds and the rain. And there was a giant granite crucifix. It was 30 feet high, made of dark granite, and there was a baptismal pool below the granite crucifix, shaped like a cross. And the cross was humming with this beautiful angelic kind of music, like in the movie 2001, the stone monolith is just humming. It's echoing like this angelic echo. And it's telling me to fall in the water and to be cleansed by the Holy Spirit and be baptized by God. And I just fell into the water in spirit, and all of a sudden, all the suffering left my astral body. And there was no bliss, just perfectly no more suffering. And then, like a mother, it was a very motherly feminine energy, carried me up above the rain clouds, above the house, into the clouds. And I could see, I said, oh my God, David, you're dead, you died. I mean, I can't believe you froze to death and you're gone. You know, where are you going to go now? And little diamonds of light, I mean, trillions of them, came from beneath, above, behind, and in front of me. And they just rushed together and made this deafening sound, just whoosh. And all of a sudden, the atoms of light together and materialize the body of Jesus Christ. And Jesus is standing in front of me, blazing like 1,000 of our suns in brightness, and so much love and ecstasy, even brighter than the light, so much peace, so much beauty, so much grace, so much power. I saw the whole universe coming from this one person. That I flat on my face in spirit, and I couldn't look. He's too powerful. He's too holy. I went, oh my God, he really is God. He's beyond all the gurus I had met from India. He's the whole thing. The whole universe is coming from this one man.
Wow.
And Jesus started coming up to me, and he's so beautiful. I look at his face for 1 second, and I'm just weeping in tears of love, just pouring torrentially. He's too holy. I can't look. And he comes up to me closer, and I touch his feet, which were bare and in sandals, and his fabric of his robe is about as bright as our sun, and so holy, so much ecstasy. I went, oh my God, he really is God. And he started teaching me. And he the first thing he taught me was that he said these words: I have appeared to a number of people throughout the universe, but at different levels of their spiritual ability. No one has ever seen me in my entirety. He said, it's not possible. And he said, even what you are seeing right now is not my entirety. And it's not possible for anyone to see the whole consciousness of Christ because of how great the whole thing is. And what I was seeing was bright as 1,000 suns. It was a blazing, you know, figure of utter, I mean, the beauty of the face. 1 second I look and down again, I can't look. And he starts to teach me about singularity. And he said that if you go back to the parable of the fall from grace in the Garden of Eden, he said the church has completely misunderstood what happened there. And then he explained it to me. And he explained it to me so fast that in a linear, logical sense, it's a whole story. It's a whole book. But when he explained it to me, I went, oh, my God, that makes perfect sense. And what he showed me was that human beings were all originally created in the first clear light of heaven, all of us. And to fall into duality was part of our spiritual evolution. To go into duality, we would suffer. But out of the suffering, compassion would be born, and we would eventually accelerate beyond the first light that we were created in, and we would reach higher and higher states of God realization. But he said when Adam and Eve took in the knowledge of good and evil, if you look at the scripture, it clearly says that God warned them, if you take in this knowledge of good and evil, you will die. And it's not that you will die because you disobeyed God. He's just saying God said you will actually die. And Jesus showed me that in the light we were one. We were singular. There was no such thing as good and evil. There was only God consciousness, only perfect peace and bliss and ecstasy. But what happens is, as soon as the consciousness of the mind partakes of this knowledge of good and evil, Jesus said, what is good and evil? It's a conflict. So if you partake of a conflict, then you become it. You actually start to radiate the conflict. And the knowledge of good and evil, it's not that as the church had previously believed that there is good and there is evil, and you're supposed to be good and then the other guy's evil. What actually happens is you can't separate the two. Taking in the whole thing, you become both. And going from a state of oneness and taking in good and evil, you now are all of the atoms in your body are going from this pure singular light to radiating conflict. And because you're radiating conflict, your cells are going to go into a state of conflict, and they're going to lose three major, major things with God. One, because your cells go into conflict, you're going to age and you're going to die. And two, Jesus actually showed me this, a force field of duality, of positive and negative energy, swirls around the soul and creates a force field that shields out the oneness of God's light. So we lose direct contact from God as soon as we take in the knowledge of good and evil. And the third thing is, this is really amazing, and I'll explain, I call these the three great inertias, the three great problems that occur when we take in the knowledge of good and evil. And I'm going to prove to you that they're still there inside of our bodies. And the third one is the atoms will not be able to travel faster than the speed of light. Einstein says that matter cannot travel faster than the speed of light. And this is really, really amazing, because when we go through each one of these, the three great inertias, I'm going to show you, one, where it is in the Gospels where this is actually written, where Jesus actually shows us the parable of how to come back to singularity. But I'm actually going to show you, from a physics perspective, what actually happens in matter that causes it to age and die is the nature of the atom. What causes it to not travel faster than the speed of light is the dual nature of the atom. And then what actually causes war and suffering on earth is the nature of duality. So what happens, Jesus shows me, is that, you know, the church taught that there really is, there's the devil, there's evil, and then there is good. And that makes a lot of sense to a person who lives in duality. But what actually happens in the mind is this. This is exactly as Jesus showed it to me. Why God said, never take in this knowledge of good and evil, for you will die. Because as soon as you take it in, you're going to become polarized. Your aura is going to be positive, negative. You're going to believe you're right and the other guy is wrong. You're going to create the devil in your mind, because you're always going to be at war, always going to be at opposition with the other. And actually, you're going to divide your own religion hundreds, if not thousands of times in arguments about anything that anybody said, because you're going to have agreements about everything, because you're going to believe you're right and the other guy's wrong. And that's what good and evil does. Good and evil is a conflict. It's nothing but a conflict, the whole thing. You have to look at the whole thing. You can't separate good from evil because you have to really understand the nature and the psychology of taking in the knowledge of a conflict. And when you really understand that we have taken in knowledge, and it's in all of our cells, it's in our double helix in our DNA, it's in the positron and the electron inside of our atoms, and you realize that, as we talked before, that consciousness is the greatest power in the universe. It's telling it all what to do. It's telling your atoms to be in this dual state. You're gonna really understand what oneness really is. I mean, it's one thing to just say, okay, we're all one. We're going to be one. And a lot of people don't get that. They're like, no, it's not all one because I disagree with you and I don't like the way you interpret this and you interpret that. But let's really break this down. And because I'm going to actually show you proof in the scriptures where Jesus was trying to teach us this singularity, but we didn't see it. It's not clear until you make it clear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you first tell people this, they're like, what do you mean? There's evil in this world. There's people who kill. There's people who actually kill. So let's look at what I call the first inertia. The first inertia is war, and it's murder, and it's killing. And we say, that is evil. Yes, yes, that's what we say today. That is evil, and it is. But when you look at what causes a violent act, let's break down a violent act so we really understand it. Firstly, we say that our religion is better than the other guys. We're right and you're wrong. Or, you know, the fanatic in any religion will say this. They'll say, you know, the Catholics are all going to fall and the Protestants aren't because the Catholics got it all wrong. And then and I studied with all of the different Christian groups, and you say the Mormons say that, oh, no, the Catholics are going to go to hell. We got it right. In fact, everybody else has it wrong. The Jehovah's Witnesses believe absolutely they got it right, and everybody else got it wrong. So what are we doing when we say we're right and the other guy's wrong? Firstly, we're alienating the other. We're saying that our children can't associate with the other because they're evil. We're telling ourselves that we're right and the other are wrong, and we're creating a force field or a barrier between us, a separation between us and the other. In fact, we've called them virtually the deluded and the devil. Now, I've studied all the great world religions in great depth. I mean, you can look in Islam and you can see how many times it's divided and how many different divisions of Islam are that actually kill each other. How many different divisions of Christianity have actually been at war with each other throughout history? But we all know how many religious wars there are. We all know that one religion or one division of the religion believes it's right over the other so much that they're going to annihilate them. So you have the Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland, you know, and their huge, long-standing wars. You have literally the Catholic Church fighting the other churches and trying to create one universal church, and there will only be one church on earth, which is what Catholic means. It means one universal church that will have dominion over this religion. And in Buddhism, you have 500 different schools or more, and you have four or five major schools, and they all disagree with each other. They all really believe the other one is better. So religious wars is one thing, but let's just take a violent person who actually committed a violent crime, whether it's rape or kidnapping or murder. And you have to establish that in order to have a violent act, first you have to have a conflict. You cannot have a violent act unless there is a conflict first. And so what Jesus is showing me is as soon as you polarize your consciousness and you're calling the other person the devil and alienating them from you, that person in society becomes ostracized. They become separate. They become the outcast. And in fact, we do this to everybody. We at this point in our history, everybody else is the other guy. He may not be the devil, but he's the other guy, and he doesn't matter. It's every man for himself, every woman for herself in the economy today. That's how it is. Survival of the fittest. But in order to commit a violent act, you have to have a conflict. And if there's no conflict, if you remove the conflict in the person's soul, it doesn't exist, you can't have violence. So we're saying that, yes, we call it evil, because evil is live spelled backwards. So if you take somebody's life, that's an evil act. But what we're saying about the knowledge of good and evil is that if there is no good and evil, in the soul. There's no conflict. And the person that doesn't have any conflict in their soul is incapable of a violent act. They're incapable of this crime against another because their conflict is dissolved. Jesus said in Matthew 6:22, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. But then he says, if thine eye be evil, your eye will be filled with darkness. But in the Gospel of Thomas, which is probably where that parable came from, it's an extra-biblical gospel that was allegedly written, and I believe it was written and told by the disciple Thomas. Jesus tells Thomas, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, but if thine eye be divided, you will be filled with darkness. Divided means duality. If you're in duality, you're in darkness, but if you're in singularity, if you're single, you're not in darkness. So what this tells us is that if our consciousness is non-dual, you're not capable of a violent act. There is nobody to kill. In fact, the most violent criminals we have in our society have the deepest neurosis, the deepest conflict going on inside of their nervous system and their consciousness, the deepest struggle, because they were not loved. When we study Charles Manson's psychology, we learn that his mother was a prostitute and gave him no love, no attention. She was hardly ever home, and he was a neglected child. He was an unloved child who creates this fantasious ego about himself, that he is Christ, and he creates this whole cult and of love and free love, and he wants to be loved. And then he becomes a neurotic psycho killer. So you can see in every case, the murderer, the violent person has the most conflict. So what Jesus is saying, there really is no good and evil, but there is because you believe there is. Because you're ingesting this knowledge of conflict and you really believe you're right, you really believe this thing about God is a football game and God's on the Lakers side and he's not on basketball. You can tell I haven't been following sports these days. But anyway, he's on one side or he's not on the other. And every religion is guilty of this, and they really believe it. Now, what he's saying in singularity is if you really believe it, then the conflict is real and it is manifest. And you are going to at least alienate yourself from the other. You're going to tell your daughter, who's Catholic, she can't marry a Protestant. She definitely can't marry a Buddhist. And your son, vice versa. And yet your daughter comes home and says, you know, she fell in love with this, you know, Indian boy, and he's from India, and he does yoga. And your mom's like flipping out. Oh, my God, you can't do that. You can't be in love with this person. Because the law says you can't, the spiritual law says you can't. I mean, that's the religion of the devil. This is how we treat each other. But God is always playing mysterious. It's always creating love between people where there's a division. So the division goes away. But we don't see it. We tell our children, there's just no way you're ever going to do that. You're never going to cross the line. If you're Jewish, you can only marry Jewish. I'm sorry. You can't cross that line. And you know, the children suffer as they get older because they realize that was the person they were the most in love with, and they're on the other side of the fence. So the first thing we do by egoifying our position in good and evil is we have solidified our polarity matrix. And the more complicated the ego gets in defining what is and what is wrong, the less likelihood it will get along with anybody is. In fact, the ego gets so solid that it can't get along with anybody because there's 100 million different possibilities of polarity matrices. What is your magnetic north good and south evil compared to your neighbor? In fact, in the 50s and 60s, it was easier to get along. It was easier for people to get married because they all listened to the same music because there wasn't too many different choices in music, and there wasn't too many different choices in food and diet, and there wasn't too many different choices in culture. But now in world culture, because a lot of it has fused, there's too many different choices, so the chances that you're going to meet somebody that's anything like you are less and less and less. So the second thing we do, the first thing we do is we create violence in ourself. And the polarity matrix of good and evil is spinning and creating a force field that shields out the light of God. So firstly, we're depressed. We're not actually in a true state of oneness. We're depressed because there's no energy. There's not enough energy because we're wasting it all on the conflict. And the conflict is perpetual. It's always going on inside. And the first thing to prove it to yourself that the conflict is still there is, have you ever had an argument with yourself? How many of you have ever had an argument with yourself where you're sitting inside of yourself going, should I do this or should I do that? Mm-hmm. Oh, I think I want to manifest this in my life, and then tomorrow you go, oh, I think I changed my mind. That's a conflict. That's going back and forth. The polarity matrix does that all day long. We have conflicts over internally over this decision-making process. We have conflicts over, you know, what should I believe or not believe? We have conflicts over business decisions. We have conflicts over everything. So that's proof that it's there. How to resolve conflicts is a much deeper issue. But when you realize that the conflict is there, firstly, it's separated you from God. It's caused all of us to not be illuminated with bliss, so, and bliss consciousness. So we're all suffering. And most of our consciousness, because the conflict is so deep, the field of consciousness have actually contracted to an area around the size of the body. So the aura is not really that bright. It's only a few feet beyond the body at the most for most people, and then it pretty much fades off after that. Because we're actually wasting all of our cosmic energy on this constant internal conflict. People who are obsessive compulsive can tend to be the most debilitated psychically, because they're obsessing over conflict issues inside of themselves that you don't seem to be able to resolve. And because they can't resolve them, they're losing all of their energy. Now, the next thing happens is we look at, okay, God said if we take in this conflict knowledge, this knowledge of good and evil, we would surely die. Well, this is where it gets really interesting, and this is when I started to discover the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle basically says the observer in consciousness is the observed. We know in the quantum physics world that when you look at an experiment at the atom and smaller, at the quantum level, that your mind is affecting the experiment. It's affecting the way the particles are spinning. We can really see that now. But what's more amazing is to realize that if you want to know what consciousness is projecting, just look in the mirror. Just look at the flesh. Just look at the structure of your atoms. And it will tell you, because we know that consciousness from our previous conversation is telling energy and matter what to do. So if consciousness is in duality, then guess what? All of the atoms that you're made of are going to be in duality. So let's look at just the DNA before we even get to the much finer level, the quantum level. The DNA is a double helix. It's a polarity matrix. It's a duality. And any polarity matrix waveform that quantum physicists have looked at have discovered that they eventually all die. They all die because they're basically vibrating against each other and they wear each other out over time. So every particle in the subatomic world has, in fact, every particle in the chemical world has what are called half-lives, that half of the material decays over a certain period of time. So every atom, everything made in nature is dying. But what we didn't realize is that what's causing everything to die is its polarity matrix. So firstly, if we look at the double helix of the DNA and we say, well, it's double and it's a dual waveform, is it my consciousness that's telling it to do that? And is it the dual waveform that is actually giving it the instructions? Is it the knowledge of conflict giving it the instruction to die? Well, scientists at the University of Texas in the Human Genome Project, which is the mapping of the entire genetic structure of the human body, have actually been able to cause a single cell in a human body to not die, to not even age. Yeah. This was done in the 1990s, in the early 90s. I read an amazing book called The Human Genome Project. And that's because they were able to isolate the cell and give it a new set of instructions. Bruce Lipton, and who's the author of The Biology of Belief, who's also a big star in my film Quantum Communication, actually has proven that consciousness tells the cell what to do. And the consciousness comes in through the cell wall and gives instructions to the DNA to do whatever it does. And he said, previously it was believed by medical doctors that your DNA were given to you from your parents and there's just simply nothing you could do about the way you were going to turn out. But they actually put these biological cells in the same cells from the same parent in different environments, and they all turned out different depending on whether they were in a violent or a harmonic or a disharmonic environment. The cells would turn out completely different. Cells in a disharmonic environment would become disharmonic, and cells in a harmonic environment would be very healthy. So what Bruce Lipton proved was that consciousness was telling the cell what to do, you see? So if the cell's in a polarity matrix and the polarity matrix causing it to age and die, then it's the instructions of the duality, which is conflict, that's telling us to die. And any good doctor can tell you that stress is the number one killer of the cell. And what is stress? It's conflict. So the more conflict you have that you've created because you believe you're right and the other guy's wrong, the more stress you're going to create for yourself, and therefore the more you're going to age and die much faster.
So how do we eliminate this duality?
Well, this is deeper. This is much, much deeper. And we're going to go there soon, but I just want to go through the three major inertias. The next thing that gets even more amazing is let's go deeper than the DNA. When quantum physicists looked at all of the subatomic particles in the universe, from the electron to the proton, which is the basic atom was, I mean, we learned this in early high school. There's a proton, positive charge, and a negative electron spinning around each other. The electron spins around the proton, and that was your really simple Niels Bohr atom, very, very simple atom. But today, as particle physicists have exploded the subcomponents of matter in these big particle smashers, when you look at the photographs and you start to study the nature of the particles, every particle has an antiparticle. So the smaller you go to the proton, there's an antiproton. And then the proton is made of quarks. There's an up quark and a down quark. Every quark is particle. There's a tau, an anti-tau, a muon, an anti-muon. You go to the electron level, which is the smallest particle we know of. There's an anti-electron, which is called the positron. So every particle and subatomic particle is dual-natured. It's polarity matrices. Polarity matrices upon polarity matrices. And because we know that information, consciousness tells energy to tell matter what to do, where is it getting its instructions? To be in the polarity matrix. From consciousness. That's us. At a very deep level, somewhere, we are holding the polarity matrix in place. The proof that it's there is that we have wars on the planet. We have division against religions. We're fighting everything in nature. We have 2 million people in prison in the United States. And all over the world, we have lawlessness. We have greed. Corporate banksters who have manipulated all of the money in the world for themselves because they don't have enough. Why don't they have enough? They can never feel like they have enough because the nature of greed is if you're not in singularity and you're not filled with love and bliss, you don't have enough. So you need more, and you need to get more wealth so you can get more attention. And you're still you still don't have enough attention. You still don't have enough power. It's relentless. The egoic structure of the most powerful people in history, you study each and every one of a person who suffers from an excessive amount of greed, and you're talking about the richest people in the world, not rich people, but the most wealthy people in the world. I mean, there's lots of millionaires in the world who don't suffer from excessive greed, but what's really killing the world right now is the super greed, the people with all the money, and they have the same problem. They think they're separate from everybody else. They're not going to give money away to causes and to fund different interesting projects because they want it all for themselves. They just want the bank pile, the number to pile up and pile up and pile up until they die. So they're suffering from this polarity matrix. Everywhere you look at what we call evil, there is a conflict inside of the person who is committing the evil act. So what singularity says is that you're not trying to just say, let's just make it all one. Let's understand polarity matrices and the limitations they cause first. Really understand that the polarity matrix is there, and then understand what happens if we remove it. Jesus says in the Gospel of Thomas, if two make peace with each other in a single house, they will say to the mountain, move from here, and it will move. So Jesus is saying, if you make the two, the polarity matrix, into one, you become so powerful that you can tell the mountain to move and it will move. Literally, there are stories in the Old Testament of angels that are literally physically, he's not just speaking metaphysically here, metaphorically, he's really talking about the mountain moving. So let's go back to my spaceship that appeared to me in Berkeley, and after 20 minutes it just went invisible in a blink of an eye, took off probably millions of times faster than the speed of light. Well, Einstein said matter cannot go faster than the speed of light. And everything in the quantum universe is dual. So where is this singularity? Where is it? Can't find it. Everything, everywhere you go, doesn't matter. You go down the subatomic particle list, every particle has an antiparticle. And we know now that consciousness is the greatest power in the universe, so it's not God's consciousness who put everything in duality, because God warned us in the Old Testament that you don't take in the knowledge of good and evil or you will die. And Jesus says over and over and over, in the Gospel of Thomas, I mean, I have it right here in front of me, and he says, for this reason I say, if one is dual or single, one will be filled with light, but if one is divided, one will be filled with darkness. We see that it is us. He literally says in the Gospel of Thomas, you know, what will you do? When you were in the light, you were one, but when you become two, he says, what will you do? This is the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas is the most wealthy place any religion I've ever read, where Jesus gives the secret to how he produced all of the miracles, all of the power, was by making the two into one. It's everywhere in the Gospel of Thomas. There are over 110 sayings in the Gospel of Thomas, and he's constantly referring to making the two into one, being the secret. Now, let's go to the spaceship. So Einstein says matter can't go the speed of light, and he's right. And these particle accelerators in Chicago at CERN, you can accelerate a proton, which has a considerable amount of the mass in the atoms of which everything we see is made. It takes an infinite amount of energy to get a proton to go 99.99% the speed of light. You can never get it to go the speed of light. So if you think of the propulsion system in the back of an airplane, the propeller in a jet engine, it's basically... A jet engine is an inverted propeller. The more force it puts out, the more energy it takes to create that force. And no matter how fast the airplane goes, what it's pushing against, which is air mass, eventually starts to put pressure on it and starts to make it unstable, and it actually heats up and burns to a crisp when you get to a really super high velocity. So an airplane can't go very fast. When a boat goes through water, the boat is using a propeller, which is its propulsion, pushing it through the water. The water pushes on the boat, making it heavier and heavier and heavier, and the boat only goes so fast before the water destroys it. And so that's duality. The atoms that the boat and the airplane are made out of are all in polarity matrices. They're all in duality. So a Nobel Prize-winning physicist named Paul Dirac comes along and makes this amazing discovery. I mean, Dirac won the Nobel Prize, but his discovery of the singularity, the non-dual background layer of the universe, virtually goes unnoticed because nobody really could understand the implications of what he had discovered. But I had been studying these non-dual teachings that Jesus pointed me to when he spoke to me that day. I've seen him three times in total. And he continued his lessons with me about singularity. Basically, because I had worked with major nuclear physicists and particle physicists for years, I started studying this stuff. I started studying quantum physics for over a decade, and I started to see the same language was in the spiritual teachings. I mean, duality was on all of matter. But there was one particle in matter that was not dual. And there they were in these particle accelerators accelerating matter faster and faster and faster, but they could never go faster than the speed of light, as Einstein said. the propulsion on the particle, the energy levels have passed, including in this new God particle, the Large Hadron Collider in Europe, which is making headlines over the world. They're looking for the God particle now. They're accelerating protons up to over 14 trillion electron volts of energy. Now, how much energy is 14 trillion electron volts? Well, when a nuclear bomb explodes, it releases 200 million electron volts of energy. So when you accelerate a particle up to 14 trillion electron volts, that's its energy mass equivalent. It's so incredibly heavy at that energy. But it's still, no matter how much power you're pumping into that particle to make it that super energetic, it still won't go 100% the speed of light. And what is the nature of the particle? It's dual. So Paul Dirac comes along and makes a discovery that turns everything upside down. We had previously talked about how physicist Raymond Chow at Berkeley got particles of light through a laser to go through a quartz sheet of glass and go into a super high frequency spin state and go faster than the speed of light. So he broke Einstein's law right there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still not fast enough to go even three times the speed of light. The distance between our galaxy and our nearest galaxy, Andromeda, is millions, 2.2 million light years from here. So traveling at the speed of light, it takes you 2 million years to get there. And if you're doing three times the speed of light, you're going to die way before you get there. So how does God do it? How does God get everywhere faster than the speed of light? This is really amazing, because before we get to Dirac's discovery, consciousness scientists have actually used atomic clocks that are so sensitive they can measure faster than light energies. They found that consciousness moves faster than the speed of light. And they've actually measured it between two different points. So consciousness.
We know how much faster?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to really see the numbers, you have to see my film Quantum Communication. You just have to see it. The numbers are in there. In fact, William Tiller at Stanford, based on experimental data, produced a model of all of the different chakras in the body, that the more realized we get in our development of meditation and coherency, which means harmonized consciousness, not only do the more powerful we get because we become coherent and we become capable of miracles, coherent actually means more and more singular, more and more at one. He actually found that the highest chakra, crown chakra, when it's fully coherent, it basically can travel between here and the Pleiades star system in about a quarter of a second, which is 440 light years away. And, that's the heart chakra. Sorry, the heart chakra is a quarter of a second. When you get to the crown chakra, you can go to the Andromeda galaxy in a fraction of a second. So, but that's still not singularity, because singularity is instant. So it's really amazing that consciousness, higher and higher levels of consciousness have been measured to be able to travel at superluminal or faster than light speed. We're still not instant yet. Well, Paul Dirac, who wins the Nobel Prize, is looking at the orbits of subatomic particles, and he sees them go into higher and higher and higher frequency orbits, which means eventually passing the gamma ray spectrum and going into what William Tiller calls consciousness or subtle energy, which is really high in frequency. And when Dirac sees them go there, he realizes they gave off their positive charge before they disappeared into this sea of singularity, where everything is no more duality. It's all pure negative. Now, I don't mean negative spiritually. I mean it only has one polarity. And Dirac doesn't really know what to do, because a negative is usually always attracted to a positive in a polarity matrix. So how could it even be negative? He didn't even know how to label it. He called his sea a sea of negativity, or pure negative energy, where there was no positivity allowed in it. In fact, Dirac found that, oh my God, the second a particle enters the sea of negativity, it has to be negative with it, so it's one, it's single. And he said, oh my God, there's no resistance because there's no polarity. Everything travels instantaneously everywhere in the universe all at once. So if you entered it, you could be anywhere in the universe in zero time. Zero time, which means because there's no resistance to movement, the amount of energy it takes to go that speed is zero. You don't even need energy. All you need is perfect, non-dual oneness to enter the sea, and you're everywhere all at once. And then he realized that particles wouldn't age or die because there's no resistance to the particle, which is what causes it to die. Now, what did God say in the Old Testament? If you take in this knowledge of good and evil, which is the polarity matrix, you are going to die. You're going to kill each other because you're all going to think you're right and the other guy's wrong. And then your cells are going to go into conflict and they're going to die. And you're not going to be able to get off your little planet called Earth and go anywhere because everything's so far away that none of your spaceships are going to be able to go anywhere because even the speed of light is too slow. God has separated, the Creator has separated us from other galaxies and star systems by such great distances that the only people who could go interstellar would be people who understand singularity. And therefore, they would be nonviolent. And that may explain why none of the UFOs have ever come here and blown us up, because they're not interested.
That's
if
interesting.
You can trust,
Stephen Hawking said just a few months ago, he released a statement saying that maybe it's not the best idea for us to be putting signals out into space trying to find UFOs, because these people might be like us and come here and just kind of mine our planet and use us as slaves.
Well, there are probably some races that are not that far away from us that might. I mean, but when you come from the perspective of being able to travel faster than light anywhere in the universe, what do you want from us? We don't have anything. We have a planet. Well, so what? There's a quadrillion planets out there and more, and so I don't need yours. There's tons of them without anybody on them. So I can go colonize that planet. Why do I need to kill you? In fact, they'd be probably more curious about who we are. And, you know, when we go deeper into this conversation, you can really go into, you know, who these beings are that have been using us and the government cover-up of the whole UFO phenomenon and how they're doing it, how they change all the atoms in their craft into a singularity, a non-dual state, and they just zip. They're gone. They're invisible. They're already there. They're between us and the Pleiades faster than the heart chakra can send coherent telepathic information. But what's amazing when you understand Tiller's model, that the heart chakra can send coherent information so fast that it can go 440 light years to the Pleiades in a quarter of a second. Then inversely, our children can be receiving telepathic visitations from beings at that distance in a quarter of a second through our chakra. We can actually, some of our dreams and messages we're getting from our guides, and especially when you have a master level teacher who's at the singularity level, the true singularity is so powerful that when masters really reach the full level, there are actually 9 identified levels in most of our religions of superconsciousness. Buddha says nirvana begins at the 7th level of the superconsciousness, and that he warns in his Lankavatara Sutra there are many masters who attain the first couple levels of superconsciousness, and it's so blissful at those states that they think they're fully realized, and they tell the world, they're a fully enlightened master, yet can't levitate a stone, they can't walk on water, they can't walk through walls, and they can't do the things that supermasters can do. And he's basically saying they're deluded. They're still not really fully realized yet, but they're still good teachers. They're still good meditation teachers. They just haven't reached the super levels of the highest levels of consciousness that any human is capable of reaching. But now we see, you know, for example, in Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, how his master, Sri Yukteswar, could shrivel up into a ball of light and go shooting out into space and appear on other planets and come back. Because we know those other planets are millions of light years potentially from us, and he does it in a blink of a very, very small amount of time. What Paul Dirac is saying in quantum physics, that he said you have to remain a singularity to use this singular field to travel faster than light or instantaneously anywhere in the universe. What he found in studying particles is as soon as a particle goes into duality, the singularity spits it out. So to answer how there could never be violence in heaven is because heaven, it's an oxymoron. Heaven is a state of singularity where no duality can exist. It can't exist there. So you can't have a conflict inside of a singularity. It's not possible. It actually rejects the duality out. So you go back to what Dirac found about the way particles behave in relation to a singularity is that how did the fallen angels fall out of heaven? the God didn't kick him out and say, get out of here, and shoot them with laser guns. By nature, as soon as you take in the knowledge of good and evil, you're conflict now. You're a being who's radiating conflict and war. You, by nature, the physics of singularity, you have to fall from oneness. You have to fall out of heaven to go into a duality. You can't come here. You can't live singularity anymore because you're now in duality. But the real deep question is, why were we even tempted to fall? Well, Jesus showed me in person that many souls never had to fall. They stayed. God created all of us in the first light. Today, there are 9 known levels of superconsciousness, and probably nobody on the planet in the 8th or the 9th. And I have my doubts whether anybody's in the 7th in the current planet, historical point that we're in right now. But nevertheless, those fields of consciousness are so powerful, so unbelievably powerful. As a meditator reaches higher and higher levels of that consciousness, they gain higher and higher levels of the power that the universe has. So William Tiller tells us that the most coherent consciousness could easily, he literally says this on camera, and this is a PhD scientist who studied consciousness in University of Stanford in California for over 20 years. When I asked him, I said, could consciousness power spacecraft at multiples of the speed of light? And he looked at me and he laughed. And he said, if you understand the math of the conversion of a wavelength that's beyond the gamma ray spectrum, and a 10-second gamma ray burst can destroy our whole sun in a blink of an eye, consciousness can create whole suns and whole stars and whole planets. Create them. And galaxies too. Because the wavelength of power beyond the gamma ray spectrum is more powerful than anything we can observe in the visible universe. It's creating everything. It's the most powerful force there is. And when you get to the level of singularity, you have an infinitum of energy potential, which means anything that's visualized or created in that perspective manifests. And that's why, you know, some very, very advanced meditators can materialize food and palaces and spaceships right in front of your eyes, and you just don't know how they did it. See, we don't see in our current period in history, this epoch that we're in, any of the teachers that we're calling enlightened masters who are able to do any of these things. But yet, when we study the history books and we go back, we realize, I mean, there's examples in the Apocryphon of John where disciples lean up against Jesus and they fall right through him. He becomes non-physical. He's not even solid anymore at times. And there are times when 3 disciples are looking at him at the same time, and to one he appears as a child, the other as an old man, and the other as a young man, all in the same second. And they're all arguing with each other because Jesus looks different to each one of them. And there are times where Jesus physically transfigured into a woman in front of his disciples and said, I am the Father, the Mother, and the Son. So when masters reach that level, they have total dictation over atoms and matter. Very, very easy to do in that state of realization.
So, David, I'm curious, is singularity, because I heard an interview about you talking about the Roswell situation, and mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, is, in your opinion, is singularity another dimension?
This is where it gets really amazing. Professor Alan Guth at MIT, a contemporary of Stephen Hawking, said that no one's been able to explain the moment before the Big Bang. We can only explain the moment after the Big Bang. And singularity answers the riddle. Because what you realize, at absolute singularity and non-dualism, time has a value of 0. Time is caused as soon as 2 polarity matrices form. They crash into each other, they produce inertia, which is resistance. Inertia is both the energy of a body in motion and its tendency to resist acceleration because it's pushing against something. An airplane is pushing against air. A spaceship is pushing against space. Space has mass. It's a real fabric. You're pushing against it. So everything's in duality. And everything in duality is trapped in time. And what I've come to realize is to understand parallel universes, every parallel universe has its own set of ratios between those two polarity matrices, or its own set of harmonic codes. And in the Gospel of the Apocrypha of John, which is a Nag Hammadi Library Gospel discovered in Egypt in 1945, it's not in the canonized Bible. That's a whole other story about why they weren't canonized by the early church fathers. What Jesus told me, it was a very big mistake by the church fathers to not canonize the Gnostic Gospels. But anyway, what happens is Jesus tells John the whole story of creation, and he says that when we took in the knowledge of good and evil, we were thrown to the lowest region of matter itself, not to the lowest geographical region of the universe, but the lowest region of matter itself, which tells you there's a code on matter that prevents us from seeing anybody else but us. Now, this is really amazing, because no matter how far the Hubble Space Telescope looks, no matter how many planets we look on, there's nobody in the universe but us right now. And I've come to believe what causes the speed of light to appear to us the way it does, which is at a particular velocity of 186,282 miles per second, is proprietary to the very signature on the polarity matrix in our atoms, in our body, in our brain. That we have a very particular set of codes that only allows us to see light at that speed. If you're at singularity, light is instantaneous. It doesn't travel at a speed. It's faster than everything. But it's actually what slows light down is the pressure that a polarity matrix puts up against it. So it's pushing against the light. Einstein said in a vacuum, which is where there's no pressure, light travels instantaneously like it does in a singularity. So it's faster than light. But we only see everything at the speed of light, and that's because the pressure of a polarity matrix sets up a field, just like Jesus showed me, that the knowledge of good and evil is creating a polarity positive and negative magnetic field around the aura, which is actually a shield, which is preventing light from coming inside of the field, which is why we suffer, why we're not in bliss all day long. And the more solid our ego gets, the more serious the polarity matrix gets, and the more we shield out the light. And the more and more depressed we get, and the more mentally, you know, we suffer until we dissolve the conflict. So what happens is I'm beginning to think that why certain cameras can, like when digital cameras came out, suddenly people were seeing UFOs on their digital camera. In fact, on earthfiles.com, Wyndham Moulton Howe's site, there's a guy in Phoenix. He's a pizza restaurant owner, took his iPhone out the window, was taking pictures of downtown Phoenix on July 18th. And an incredible UFO showed up in his camera, and he said, I never saw that with my naked eye, but it's there. And I took his photo in Photoshop and determined it's definitely not an artifact. It's not doctored in. It's really there. And the UFO I saw in Berkeley went invisible in a blink of an eye. It didn't accelerate. It just went invisible. It was gone. And so what are they doing? They have a different set of harmonic instructions on the atoms inside their spaceship. And every parallel universe has a different set of instructions, so they can't see each other. We're all stacked on the top of each other. We don't see each other. We're alone. We're alone in the universe because of our harmonic codes. Now, this may shock some of the listeners, but the moment I saw Jesus the first time blazing like 1,000 suns, and the second time I saw him on Easter morning 1997, he was blazing like 10,000 suns, and utterly I overdosed on the levels of love and ecstasy in Christ that day. I can see invisible beings. I've seen hundreds and hundreds of invisible beings since 1994 with my eyes open. I don't get a mental picture. I see them. They're there. I've seen Princess Diana the day after she died in my room in broad daylight. And I used to work on landmine and bomb detection, so I figured she was visiting me because of that issue, because I was dealing with the Princess Diana landmine fund. I walked right through Einstein on my way to the bathroom one morning, and I said, that cannot be you. You can't really be here. What Pythagoras discovered is that all of the nine planets in our solar system are full of intelligent beings that are vibrating on different wavelengths, different frequencies. Mm. We don't see anybody because we've wasted so much of our psychic energy on the internal conflict that we don't have enough energy to see the faster-than-light energies because our polarity matrix is such that it's pushing most of the light away. We're only seeing a little sliver of it.
So our idea of life and what, because for life by our definition to exist, we need water, oxygen, carbon, all of those, the building blocks of life, and that's what we're searching for on other planets are the potential building blocks of life. But if there are living beings on those planets now, then they must be existing by a different definition of life.
No, actually, the Chandra X-ray telescope, which sees wavelengths of light as deep as, you know, extreme ultraviolet and X-rays, can see now invisible hydrogen, which is water is two-part hydrogen, one-part oxygen. So everything is a hydrogen compound. Everything starts with hydrogen. And the fact they're now seeing whole galaxies that are completely invisible, and they're in super high ultraviolet frequency hydrogen. But you can't see it to the naked eye. So if hydrogen is the building block of all life, hydrogen and oxygen, and you can get a hydrogen molecule to vibrate in an invisible wavelength, you won't see it, but it's there. Scientists have discovered about heat. We say, well, this planet's too hot or it's too cold, right? You know, so that no one could live there. Well, what is heat? Heat is resistance to light. So when electromagnetism, which is what light is, comes up against a body, a cell has a membrane. A membrane is held together by a polarity matrix. The definition of the vibrational rate of that resistance field, the membrane, is what sets up how hot it's going to get in relationship to light. But if you put a super high frequency membrane in the presence of super high frequency energy, which is light, it's not going to experience any heat. So we are attached to this idea that if there's going to be intelligent life in the universe, it has to be vibrating at the same rate we are. But why are digital cameras showing people are taking pictures in an empty field and there's a flying saucer that shows up in the picture, but it's not there to the naked eye? And then they take a picture and there's a person standing there who shouldn't be there because there's nobody there when they took the picture. I mean, I've seen this over and over and over again ever since digital cameras came out. I've even seen people take pictures of a person with a digital camera and the person is not even there.
Wow.
There's just an empty background because that person is vibrating at such a high rate the camera misses it and gets the background. See, we think we're so solid, this flesh. It is to us because of the relevance of everything that we experience as matter. But when scientists look at matter, it's made of subatomic particles. And particles are both particles and wavelets of energy. The spaces between the particles and the waves are so vast that scientists have discovered the atoms with which we're made is most empty space. So we're mostly empty space, but we think this is so solid, this thing. You know, it's like heavy and it needs food and water. But to another dimension, this would appear as a vaporous ghost to another dimension. Now, when I see ghosts very clearly in the middle of the night sometimes, I put hands right through them. They are non-physical to us, but they are there. They are clearly there. In previous studies, most psychiatrists would say, well, that person's having delusional, they have schizophrenia. But a scientist named Dr. Gary Schwartz, who's a Harvard-Yale psychiatrist, set up a lab at the University of Arizona at Tucson, where he actually uses cameras that can see deep into the invisible. And he studied many cases, and I know Gary well. He's appeared in all of my films, The Voice and Quantum Communication. They've done studies where a person is actually seeing something, and it's really there. It's really there. They see it on the camera in the invisible.
So, David, there are so many questions that are coming up from myself and from the chat room, and we've only got 13 minutes left on the show, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. I know you're a really busy guy, but is it possible that we could continue this discussion another day?
Oh, yeah, we can do another show for sure because there's a lot of places we can go now that
we're scratching the surface here.
Foundation, yeah.
Okay, well, awesome. I'll set that up with you later, but I wanted to let you know that we are running out of time. Is there anything that you'd like to spend the next 10 minutes focusing on?
Well, Jim, before we take calls, just briefly, Pythagoras, the great Greek mathematician, the founder of trigonometry, the father of the modern music system, said that all of the planets were inhabited by beings of light that were vibrating at different dimensions, which he has personally seen. Dante the Alighieri, the Italian poet and Catholic mystic, traveled to many of the planets, including the sun, and found many of the saints living on these different spheres and bodies in the solar system. I myself have had, from meditating, anybody who practices meditation every day for more than 10 years is going to have mystical experiences if you're doing the right meditation and you're doing it properly. So you can experience this for yourself. So if you want to expand your consciousness and practice meditation, I encourage people to look at my films, and I have meditations on my website at voiceentertainment.net, or you just practice deeper into the practice that you're already doing, and these experiences will start to happen. They really will start to happen. So, yeah, let's take some calls.
Awesome. Okay, so if you want to get on the air and ask a question, the number is 1-347-202-0129. I'm going to start with some of the questions that have been going on in the chat room. Dominica Amore wants to know, how many people do you think are able to see things as you do, other beings and in other vibrations?
Well, there are certainly a number of cases of children that we know that are seeing beings in other dimensions. As children get older, the ego gets stronger, and the auric field starts to shield out more of the light, and they stop having these experiences. I have literally seen hundreds of beings. I've seen Jesus Christ 3 times, the Virgin Mary 5 times, which is the most incredible masters I've ever met. I've met Einstein, Princess Diana, and I've met beings just who appear as balls of light and tell me what star system they're from. I'd never even heard of that star system until I researched it, Arcturus, and sure enough, it's a star system. And those little balls of light actually have shown up in the crop circles, and there are many people that believe the Arcturians are making the crop circles. And I've met them with my eyes open. You know, how many other people? Gary Schwartz, University of Arizona, Tucson, is using very advanced military cameras where the military came to him because they were seeing these beings showing up on their cameras. And these are very, very expensive, like, you know, $700,000 cameras that can do this. So they're not, you can't buy them anywhere. But even your own digital camera, at times, if you see an apparition on the camera, send me the photo to David Sereda, S-E-R-E-D-A, at hotmail.com. I'd love to see it. I don't know, ultimately, how many there are. There are not many people that I know that have seen as many as I've seen, but I also don't know many people that meditate every day for 30 years. There's not that many of us that have been meditating every single day for that long, but there are some.
Sorry, and you meditate for quite a long time. What do you suggest the average person who is, you know, it might be a struggle to meditate even for 5 minutes? How long do you recommend people do to get started?
Well, if it's a struggle, start with 5 minutes, but do it every day. Don't miss a day. Then increase it to 15 minutes within a month, and then by a year, try to get up to 30 minutes a day. And slowly increase it. That's what I did. You know, by the time I was 18, I was meditating every single day, even though I was introduced to the meditation at the age of 13. So the benefits, I mean, the main background experience of meditation is when it gets advanced, you go into incredible cosmic ecstasy and bliss states that are absolutely wonderful. Then your consciousness expands to the point that you can have a dialogue with the creative force of the universe. And whether you're an architect or a doctor or a poet or a musician, your creative potential will expand through meditation. You will have deeper levels of super flash genius insights for yourself and for whatever material it is you're working on. But you think of a kung fu master, you know, to get a black belt, maybe it takes 8 years, and you practice every day. I was told by Indian gurus that if I meditated for 7 years, you could get enlightened. And I've been doing it for 30 years, and I've been all the way to the sixth field of superconsciousness, which is so unbelievably, blindingly blissful. That there's, and it's those states described at the end of my film, The Voice, are still impermanent. The Buddha says only the seventh and beyond are permanent. Nirvana begins at the seventh. So to master the first six level of samadhis is a lifetime of practice. It's a lifetime of practice. And I still have not reached the permanent state, the seventh state and beyond. So, but when you see the end of The Voice, you'll really understand that those seven levels of superconsciousness are common to Islam, to Christianity, Judaism, and Buddhism very, very clearly. The eighth and the ninth are reserved for the most super enlightened beings, and I don't think there's anybody around like that on our planet.
So what, in your opinion...
You have to, it's how bad you want this. You know, the question is, what do people do if they are struggling? You know, how many hours a day do you watch TV? How many hours a day does this person who doesn't have time to meditate? It has to become your priority. If you want to expand your consciousness, you have to do the practice every day, and you have to increase to at least an hour a day to get really serious results.
And Les Zarbres wants to know, how do you know when you cross each threshold or state of consciousness, like you've gotten up to the sixth level?
I'll give you an example. And this happened in Vancouver to me December 22nd, 1986, and December 23rd. I was taken by an angelic guide into the first clear light heaven. I'm going to make it really short. The ecstasy and the love there and the peace are a million times better, a millionfold instantly, than anything I've ever experienced on Earth. The best love or the best ecstasy in the human form, a million times, and it's permanent. It doesn't leave. It doesn't fluctuate like an emotion going up and going down. When I entered the membrane to go into the second heaven, the ecstasy starts to crush you because that particular body of consciousness that you're embodying, it can't take it. The ecstasy becomes torrential. It's like it's raining ecstasy on you and you're about to explode, and you literally explode into the second. The second is a million times brighter than the first, a million times, but the second field of consciousness is such that it can sustain it. You can't even believe you're now in a million times the first. So it's not subtle. The third is a million times the second. The third is the greatest limit of ecstasy, love, and peace, and unnameable words and consciousness that a form limited to the human arms and legs and head can contain. Once you go to the fourth, it's the beginning of the cosmic. It's when I went into the fourth, you become a giant spherical field of consciousness. You can no longer be confined to the limbs. When Buddha describes in the Dhammapada going through each of the six samadhis and into the seventh, once he realizes the seventh, he comes all the way back down to the first, goes all the way back up to the seventh and down again until he could put it in a language, a teaching, which becomes a vehicle for you to practice so you can attain nirvana. But the seventh is permanent. Once you reach the seventh, you never have to practice at doing it again. It becomes permanent. The problem is, for example, when I was in India at the tree where the Buddha was enlightened, even before Buddha attained the seventh, he was in the higher fields. The fifth and the sixth, you can't move your body. It cannot move. It's too powerful to move the body. And Buddha stood, they have footprints, which they casted in stone, where the Buddha stood for 3 months, day and night, in the same spot. His physical body could not be moved day and night for 3 months. Some monks say it was 3 days, but I don't know a single person who can stand for 3 days and nights in a single spot. The sign of a seventh-level master in Buddhism is called an arahant or a tathagata, full Buddha, which means seventh level. The sign is they have to be able to hold their body in meditation for 24 hours without moving a muscle in the lotus posture. That's a symptom because the consciousness is so far beyond the body, the magnetism of the consciousness holds the posture, but the consciousness is not in the body at all. It's not astrally projected, it's just in this super expanded cosmic field. And I've been all the way up to the sixth, and I've seen the edge of the seventh, and it's unspeakable how powerful it is there. It's simply unspeakable. And this is, every human being has the potential to reach these levels of consciousness. Everyone.
Awesome. Well, it's, wow, we've just got so many questions coming in through the chat room, and I want to thank everyone in the chat room who's been listening. They're all wanting to know if we can extend the show. We have been on for 3 hours now. That's as far as Blog Talk will allow us to go. But David has agreed that he will come back another day to speak more. Some people are saying they want to meet you in person. They want to see more information about you. So, David, how can people contact you and get more information about you?
Well, the best way to contact me, they can go look for David Sereda, S-E-R-E-D-A, on Facebook, or send me an email. I do private sessions in Sedona, but coming in September, I'm going to be having a baby with my wife, our first baby, so I will not.
Congratulations.
Will not be on the map anymore until October, probably. So that's the best way to get a hold of me. And I also do workshops in Sedona from time to time, depending on interest.
Wonderful. And you have films out through voiceentertainment.net. You have a number of films that you've spoken about throughout this show. And then there's also, if you want more information about the crystal jewelry that we were talking about in the first hour, that is lightstreamtechnologies.com. And again, you can find the links to contact David on the main Blog Talk Radio page for this episode. Please do favorite the show, friend Namaste Radio, because we are going to have David on again. And if you're interested, he has, then you definitely don't want to miss out on that. David, 90 seconds left in the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I want to say thank you, Marie, and thank you to Constance for having me on this wonderful show. And I look forward to continuing the conversation. I think if we're going to continue it, we should do it soon. Because, again, in September, I'll be disappearing for a month or so.
Definitely. Okay, well, I'll contact you ASAP. Thank you so much, David. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. So, again, that was David Sereda. You can find him at lightstreamtechnologies.com or voiceentertainment.net. We're going to get cut off here, so tune in again. If you'd like to connect with our authors and blogs and speakers at namastepublishing.com in our global community, please do that. And again, we will have David on the show. I'll try and get him on again as soon as possible. So again, favorite the show, friend us so that you can keep up to date on the next David Sereda episode. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a wonderful day. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.